distinguish between the neuroses and the virtues. This is the essence of the job of being a Buddhist. If you could argue everything up to there is preparation, you know. Now we start the real job. So any questions about so far what we've discussed? I'm going to go into detail about what is attachment, what is aversion, what are these things. But are there any questions? And if not, I'm happy to carry on. Okay, I'll carry on. All right. So keeping in mind the end result, Buddha, free of all the delusions and full of all the goodness, that's the end result of all this work. The preliminary work of getting the teacher and appreciating this human rebirth and thinking about impermanence and death and wanting to turn to the Buddha for advice and then taking his advice, that begins the process of abiding by the laws of karma, controlling our body, controlling our speech. Why? Because that stops sowing more negative seeds in our mind for our future suffering. And then you purify the karmic seed you already planted. So this is preparing you and getting you ahead of the game. So now you can do the real job of actually working on your mind. Because all the way from here to Buddhahood is what you're doing. That never ceases. Never ceases. Even on the compassion wing, you're continuing to remove the delusions in relation to others, which we'll talk about. In the first stages of practice, you're removing the delusions for your sake. So here in the compassion, now in the compassion, when we get there, you're removing the delusions that create the barriers between self and other. So it's the same job all the way to Buddhahood, but the emphasis is different. So to do this, and we have to understand what Buddha means. If he says we can get rid of all the rubbish and grow all the goodness, we better know how to identify rubbish and how to identify goodness. I mean, the words are simple enough, but the Buddhist analysis of this stuff is really quite, it goes into great depth. We know the words in our culture, anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, but we have a whole different analysis of what they are, where they come from, and what causes them. So like I said before, when we looked at the first business about the mind, how we have sensory and mental, and within mental we live at the level of conceptual. So the really tough one to see, because we think about emotions, someone said human emotions. We look at these three states of mind, all of them narrow down to these three: ego grasping, attachment, and aversion. Forget ego grasping. We'll go to that one later when we talk about emptiness. But these two are effectively the things, the main ones in our day. We go 1,000 times a day between attachment and aversion. When we can understand this process in our daily life, this is really quite profound. And this is distinct to the Buddha. Okay. So we know, if you like, we go up and down all day. We go up and down. Bad things happen, you get upset. Good things happen, you get happy. We know that. We know that. We know that. And we know we want the good things and we don't want the bad things. So looking at the neurotic aspect of that, that's attachment. Attachment is this junkie in us that runs the show, that's completely instinctive because we've practiced it for so long. It's at the level of assumption. And two ways of putting it, and they're both kind of brutal. It wants only the good things. It can only bear the good things. Our attachment wants only the nice things to see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, basically. So we know that. We know, so we read nice news, we have happy flowers and lovely delicious food and lovely sunny day and sweet breezes that touch our skin that's nice and people are sweet and kind. We say, I had a good day. And why? It's because attachment got what it wanted. And that means then pleasant feelings were triggered. So feelings, if we look at this third category of states of mind, like I mentioned before, call them like the mechanics. Oddly, one of those is called feeling, but not the word we use. We use feeling like an emotion. But here, Buddha's saying we either have a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or a neutral feeling. So forget the neutral, okay? But think of your life. You either have pleasant feelings, which we call happiness, or unpleasant feelings, which is what we call suffering, isn't it? It's very clear, isn't it? We know that. And we all know we want the pleasant ones and don't want the unpleasant. And I talk about feelings. But we're so addicted to believing that the pleasant day out there is the cause of my pleasant feeling and the ugly words out there are the cause of my unpleasant feeling. That's the analysis we give in our world. The Buddha's analysis is no. Attachment is this junkie in us that's frantic only for the nice things. Why? Because they trigger nice feelings. And we only, really the bottom line is we only want nice feelings. And of course we think the flowers and the pretty weather do it. But they're just the catalysts. They are merely the secondary cause, the catalysts. The real thing is the internal process. And this demands much inner discipline and awareness to notice this. Easy to hear the words, but it's not our experience. We interpret it differently. Are we communicating? So basically, attachment is a junkie that only wants nice feelings. And the method to get it is contact nice, pretty objects. Think about it. In other words, another way to put it, which is the suffering of samsara, Buddha says, and this is the subtler level of suffering. This is, what we're talking about here is the subtler level of suffering when we get the nice things. When we get the bad things, that's the gross level of suffering, suffering of suffering. The second one is called the suffering of change. When attachment gets the nice things. So when attachment wants the chocolate cake, you then manipulate to get it, and you get the chocolate cake, and it goes in the mouth. What does it do? It triggers a pleasant feeling. We know that. That's what we want. I mean, the cake is the only method we have. We can't bypass the cake and get a delicious feeling. We've got to get the cake first. You get my point? It's kind of exhausting. So our method for getting pleasant feelings, which is happiness, is by getting what attachment wants. So it's quite exhausting, hard work. You get my point? In other words, we don't know how to trigger good feelings unless it's an object that triggers it. I mean, it's such hard work. We've got to keep finding objects all the time, whether it's a sound, a smell, a taste, a pleasant word. We can't just sit there and have pleasant feelings. We wouldn't know how to do that. You get my point here? You know what Buddha's saying? Hey, babes, I've got a really good method that bypasses the necessity for things. The long-term goal, the long-term method, is give up attachment. And what are you left with? Good feelings. It's another method to get good feelings. Give up attachment. And he says the difference is between that happiness and the happiness we get is this one lasts. This other one is short going. Because we know when you start getting the pleasant feelings once the first piece of cake's in the mouth, it's the best possible best feeling. But it's downhill from there. We know that. The second piece is already disappointing. And then you keep wanting that happy feeling and you think maybe the third piece will do it. Maybe the fourth piece will do it. And by then you're exhausted and you want to vomit. I mean, get the point. Buddha's accurate. He says this is a subtler, more nuanced level of suffering. It's called the suffering of change. We think we're getting happiness when we eat the cake, but what do you think you end up with? The suffering of a stuffed stomach. This is scientifically true, but we forget. So the same object that gives you pleasant feelings is the same object 5 pieces later that causes you to vomit. But we forget the second part. We just remember the first bit and we say, oh, tomorrow it'll work again. Are we communicating here? Yeah. This is technically correct. We get it. This is Buddha's analysis. We can see it's true. He didn't make it up. It's just we don't want to know about it, that's all. Because we're junkies. But this is where what Lama Yeshe is trying to inspire us. By just getting some concentration. You can taste that capacity for pleasant feelings. It's your own natural state. So even just in meditation, some people get it by accident. Then you think, oh, well, I've got a really, you know, religious experience. You did in a way. But it's proving to us that even when you can steady your mind a little bit, to that degree, there's a pleasant feeling. It's natural. So when Lama talks about getting all the way to single point of concentration, talking about rapture, ecstasy, he somehow learned these words. So all pleasant feelings are anything from a mild pleasant feeling to rapture or ecstasy. We don't throw those words around every day. Oh, I had some ecstasy yesterday. We think it's a drug. You understand? But this is the capacity of the mind. It's technically the Buddha's view of the capacity of the mind to the degree it is unencumbered by delusions is the bliss we can experience. So if you get too junky, the biggest mistake about that, some people have the capacity to experience bliss in their meditation, but they haven't practiced, so they just become junkies. That's not the point. That's missing the point profoundly. This what Lama's giving us is to excite us, but it's just a bonus. It's the bonus, that's all. But it's showing us our potential. It's showing us that our mind has the potential to be blissful and peaceful without relying upon an object. So that helps us, encourages us to give up attachment. But if we get attached to the meditation, then you're in serious trouble. You just destroy yourself. So you've got to practice knowing your mind well, going step by step, disciplining your body, your speech, and then your mind, and doing lots of purification and practices and all those things, you know. That's the stuff that purifies us, that helps us do this job properly. So attachment is this junkie that's always there, constantly, spontaneously, instinctively desperate to get, actually to get, not even the object, but to get the nice feelings. That's all attachment wants. So this is when we understand this process. It's very humbling and very inspiring, but also depressing. But I always use the example, I always use about this particular mother I met years ago whose boy was a professional fisherman. And then he died scuba diving. And then she wondered where he'd been reborn. She heard about karma. And she went to Geshe Lama Khonchog. She asked me, I said, I don't know, but go and ask Geshe Lama Khonchog. Well, he's clairvoyant. He's clairvoyant, knows emptiness, body teacher, the works, you know, he's got the lock. But these lamas are very humble. They don't tell you what they see sometimes, but sometimes they do when the person's mind is ready. So she went to him. She was devastated when she heard about karma. Her boy had been a fisherman since he's born. As soon as he went fishing, he fell in love with fishing. So this, I'm going to explain this. I'll do a little analysis of that. But the incidental part of the story is that she went to see him and asked where her boy had been reborn, because he died scuba diving at the age of 29 or something. And he spent his life killing fish. I mean, that's what a fisherman is. So he said, first he was born in the animal realms and now he's in the hell realms. So, of course, it's shocking to hear. But she was very marvelous. Her response was, oh, no, what can I do for him, she said. And he laughed sadly and said, what do you mean for him, for everybody? And she was really moved by this. I met her years later. She's not a Buddhist, but this touched her heart deeply. So it was helpful to hear that. It was very curious because, you know, who wants to hear that? So let me do this analysis about the relationship between attachment and feeling, and this is how we get stuck in samsara and our misconceptions about all this stuff. So let's think about how he got born. So first of all, these four tracks of karma. One is the type of rebirth. He got the good one from one of his powerful non-killing karmic results in his big main bank fault. One of those was triggered before he stopped breathing in the past life, and he's got a program to go to mummy's womb in this lovely, nice lady in California. Second, he's got lots of good tendencies, the second track of karma, born with very kindness, with intelligence, with generosity, a good human being. But like a lot of people in our culture that have all those qualities, he had a tendency to kill. Not people, you know, who are seen as monsters. Not poodles. He would have been seen as a monster. He had to secretly go out at night to kill poodles, wouldn't he? Because we love our poodles. But fish. But that's cool in our culture, isn't it? Do you see my point? So he had the good karma to have a good reputation because he was killing fish, which is unfortunate for him. If he had imagine if he was going around killing poodles, he'd be seen as a monster. He'd be put on death row practically. Only because we're attached to poodle woodles, but not to fishy wishies. Except to eat them. Do you understand? We're so irrational in our attachments. So anyway, this is the point. So he was like, I don't know, a little boy, four, five, I don't know, when he first met fishing, and this is how karma works, this is all these pieces, how they come together. He never thought of fishing before. Suddenly he meets a condition called fishing. Instantaneously, it's like triggers his memory, which means triggers the memory of having done it before, which means the karma of having done it before. So instantaneously, because of his past habit of killing, instantaneously pleasant feelings were triggered. Immediately he saw it, pleasant feelings were triggered. And then a millisecond later, so quick it's like the same time, attachment kicks in, which then makes it look completely divine, calls it a delicious thing to do. So naturally, he wants to do it again. Why? Because he had a good feeling. We judge everything by our good feelings. If we have a pleasant feeling, you know, for us, most is probably just cake, watching a movie, having a nice husband. I mean, some people, unfortunately, have it from killing fish, torturing. My friend on death row in Kentucky, and I'm going to see him tomorrow in Kentucky, I said it, yeah. A friend of Mitch, who's my friend, is a Buddhist there. And he told me about him years ago. I know him. He's in that movie, you see his face in Chasing Buddha, smiling guy. Mitch said, Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. Can you imagine being born with a tendency to want to torture all the time? I mean, we've got the tendency to want to eat too much cake. We feel bad about it. It's just habits, karmic imprints, karmic imprints, karmic imprints. When you know that, you can have compassion. So there's this guy, I've got, clearly he's on death row because he tortured people. At least he can't do it there. But his mind, continually on his mind, whether he likes it or not, that's the depth of karmic imprints. And we know ourselves, our stuff, we can't stop our stuff either. Old habits reverberating in our head. So here, but this man attached to fishing. So because that habit was there, seeing the event triggered the memory, the karma memory, if you like, because everything's imprinted in the mind, instantly pleasant feeling is triggered. Instantly. And powerful pleasant feelings. And then powerful attachment kicks in, which is the one that makes it look more delicious than it really is. Paints a blissful picture of it in his mind. And that's the picture he carried the rest of his life. When he thought fishing, which he thought about all the time, he saw it through the lenses of attachment, which made it look beautiful. So of course, we all want good feelings. So of course he thought fishing was the cause. We think cake is the cause. Well, of course we think it is. It's automatic. We don't question that process. That's what we have to do. And that's why believing in our feelings is the worst misconception. We do. We're junkies. Because all we want is good feelings. We're frantic for good feelings. Frantic. We'll do anything we can to find any object to trigger good feelings. And then, of course, he thinks it's good. And he was born in a culture, like in California, where he was born, where you don't criticize fishing. It's seen as good, you see. So he spent his life. So that means he never, and this is a killer about attachment. Attachment's main job, apart from the craving and the wanting and the manipulating and the possessing, its main function is to exaggerate, to make it more delicious than it really is. That means he was blinded from seeing the fish in his boat every day for 25 years, flapping their little bodies. He saw flapping bodies, but he didn't see, I wonder what they're flapping their body for. He just saw flapping bodies. My old uncle, my auntie Rabina Bliss, my mummy was called Agnes Bliss, my auntie Rabina Bliss married a Lithuanian, so she became Rabina Arkoshauskas. We thought Bliss was a silly name, so anyway, she became Rabina Arkoshauskas. And he was this nice Lithuanian man, who went fishing in the fishing season, quail killing in the quail season, duck shooting in the duck season, eel killing in the eel season. That's what his job was. Yeah, nice veggie garden. But he never used spray. He said, oh, the insects can enjoy the vegetables. Anyway, that was what he did. He killed all these animals, you know. My poor auntie, we called her Ninny. She couldn't stand. She was a vegetarian. She just cried every day because she had to skin the poor dog because she was trying to be a good wife, you know. Anyway, whatever. But the point is, he bought a property up on the river between the two states, New South Wales and Victoria, which was the ideal place for a fisherman and a duck shooter and a quail shooter and an eel killer. Do you understand? He was in heaven back up there. So basically we got there and we swim in the river because we'd sunbake in the sun, you know. And I had never in my life thought of fishing. My father did it, but I'd never thought of fishing. It never rose in my mind as a concept. And then I didn't know how fish died. I had no idea about it. But he'd come up with these bags of fish and he'd chuck them on the ground next to the river in the 120 degree sun. And he'd walk away. I'd say, Stassi, we called him Stassi. Stassi, I said, they're still alive. He said, well, of course, that's how they die. I never thought of it. I was boggled, mind boggled. I could not believe the suffering, to think of the suffering of the fish. And this boy, kind man, because of the habit, because of attachment, he never saw suffering. That was the tragedy. His mummy hated fishing, but she never criticized, she said. And she went fishing with him one time. And because she didn't have attachment to fishing, she didn't have any veils in front of her eyes, so she saw nakedly the truth. The fish weren't happy. Are we communicating here? So he wasn't brutal. This is the tragedy of attachment. As a honey-covered razor blade, it looks like kindness. But it blinds us from seeing the harm we're causing. And that's where attachment, when we harm others through attachment, it's not as heavy maybe as aggression, as wanting to harm. Fishermen don't want to harm, but it blinds you from seeing the suffering. He never saw them suffering. That's the thing that's fascinating. This is how our delusions work. Attachment is the one that drives us. It's this motor. It's most subtle energy, its heaviest energy, the deepest energy, the most primordial from the practice, having practiced it for countless lifetimes, is that it's the energy of never having enough dissatisfaction, which is this hunger, which causes us to yearn after something out there because something's missing. Then we jump it onto the five objects of the senses, depending on our karma, it's going to be this or this or this. So at least if we just do it to, you know, but if it doesn't include other humans or other beings, it's not so bad. You just harm yourself. Too much cake, you know, too much pornography. Because we're not harming another. You're just feeding yourself. It's not being moralistic. It's practical. But then you start to harm others with it, like raping people, stealing from people, lying to people. You understand? When it harms others, it's more heavy. Killing people based on attachment. That's when it's heavy, obviously. So that's why we at least start stopping those things at the beginning stages of practice. But how these things work together. Karmic habit meets the object, triggers a pleasant feeling, catch and kicks in, makes it look delicious. The whole thing is sealed. From there on, never question, ever once, fishing is good. And because the world accepts it, he continues to do it. We need to look at these things and unpack these assumptions and understand this process, how it works technically. This is the Buddhist analysis, you know. And so so that's the point. Attachment is a junkie for pleasant feelings. That's it. And the only way we can trigger them is do something out there. Harm others, eat cake, jump on boys. Not being rude, not being mean, just talking. Now, our deepest attachment is where we just really harm ourselves, the most profound level of attachment, where we harm ourselves. And this is primordially deep attachment. They don't really teach us until we get to what they call the eight worldly dharmas, that strange phrase we hear when you read the Tibetan literature. The deepest attachment we have, the most primordial, since we're born, it's almost the subtlest attachment of all, a function of ego grasping, the root delusion. Attachment, basically, putting it in simple words, it's the craving to be liked. The craving to be seen in a good light. We are junkies for that one. And this proves how absolutely tragic attachment is. The implication is that why would I want other people to like me? Because obviously I'm not worthy until then. That's the energy that we have. I am nothing until someone says I'm something. That's the depth of the suffering of this attachment. Because you analyze it. Think about it just sort of in simple words. They call us attachment to reputation. Think about it in simple words. We crave every second. That's why to be seen in the good light, which means we're manipulating, we're adjusting our behavior all the time, watching like a hawk to make sure we say and do something, you know, unless we're out of control, then we do crazy things, to make sure the person responds nicely. Phew, they must keep liking me, you know. And in a millisecond a person criticizes, doesn't like us, doesn't respond properly, we have a panic attack. They say that the yogis in the mountains who really practicing, have given up everything. Until they're the most advanced levels, they're still thinking of what the people in the village are thinking about them. And we start to look into our mind. This conversation of attachment to how we're seen is there in our head all day. It's embarrassing to hear it. We often don't hear it until we really start to see our minds well. Always adjusting it, always wanting to be seen as good, wishing people can see us, wishing they would know I'm doing this, hoping that they're going to do it, I'm going to tell them this. Everything is, well, you know, when we're really deluded, everything we're saying is always in reference to how we're seen by others. So the other one is, this is where we look at all the different delusions. Another delusion that's very similar to that, that's really confusing to us, it could seem the same, is a delusion called pride. This is fascinating. All delusions are an overinflation, an over-exaggeration of certain qualities. That's the delusion's essential job. All the ones in this first category, the emotional disturbing emotions, attachments, all their key function, anger over-exaggerates a person or thing's ugliness. Flip that over and guilt, you're the object that over-exaggerates your badness. Attachment over-exaggerates something's niceness. Jealousy is a distorted mind that when someone else is happy, actually it's based on anger. Especially if my boyfriend is smiling because someone else is smiling at him, not looking at me. You know, it's terrifying to us. Pride is a very tricky one that over-exaggerates our importance. Now, we never think we have pride, but we all love to admit to the flip side, which is the over-exaggeration of our badness, which is low self-esteem. But the point is, we wouldn't have that if we didn't have pride. It's very depressing to hear that. We do not, most of us don't, we can see pride, the classic example of pride is a person that really is inflated. You see them walking through like that, you really can tell they're so arrogant. That's pride, it's the obvious one. But when you see a little mousy person who's shy and blushes when people look at them, or you think, oh, the poor person, that's the flip side of pride. Stop being horrible. A person who doesn't have low self-esteem or pride would be content with who they are. They'd be happy. They don't mind if they're fat or thin or skinny or loud or dark. They're happy who they are. They're not worried. There's a big difference, I tell you. So low self-esteem is just when you're not getting people to think you're important. Oh, I must be a nobody. I must kill myself. I'm nothing. You're really a nice person to me. No, I'm not. You know. We recognize these. But these are all these voices in our mind all the time. We have to learn to distinguish them. They're so tricky. Jealousy and anger and compassion and kindness and this and resentment and wishing that people suffer. There's so many. But again, remember Buddha's identified 84,000. But even that's a half a dozen is hard work. And there are all these roommates in there all chatting, all together. So you've got to identify them. Hear their voice. Hear what anger says. Hear what attachment says. Hear what low self-esteem says. Hear what arrogance says. They're all voices. They're all concepts in our mind, but all mixed together like a big soup. We can't tell the difference because we've never paid attention. That's our job. That's our job. Are we communicating here? They're the ones that are causing us to break our hearts. They're the ones that are causing us to suffer, you know. And they're so tricky. Like I talk about, you know, like in relationships, like with your mummy or with your partner, I always kind of make a sort of cliched idea. You got the good girls and the bad girls, let's say. And I always think of myself as I'm one of the bad girls who causes trouble. Like in our household, there were 7 children, you know. We all had our own style. We all joke about it now. So one of my sisters, her main style was to make sure when daddy got home, when he was a bit drunk, keep mummy out of the way and keep Rabina over here and make sure Julie doesn't know. She'd manipulate the whole household. Do you understand? She's kind, she's wonderful, she's a gorgeous person, but she was what the world calls a worrier. You understand? And that means she had to control all the bits and pieces so the apple cart wouldn't get overturned. Are you kind of with me here? And that is driven by kindness, but it's unbelievable attachment. Because her attachment, couldn't handle the apple cart upset. But then that's the good girl mode. And then, you understand? And then it's still attachment, not criticizing. We've all got these things. Now, my mode was I didn't worry if daddy walked in, he'd upset the apple cart and there was a fight and he'd yell, what the hell? And I'd jump in the middle of the fight, probably, and stir it up and turn over the apple cart on purpose. Probably, most likely. So all different, you understand? And in the same way that when my father drove a car, my mother would be having panic attacks. Julie, this other sister, I shouldn't tell her name, I'm sorry. My sister, I love my sisters, all my sisters, I adore them. She'd have a panic attack, but I'd be the kind of person, so I didn't worry, I didn't care how he drove, I just relaxed, you know, I didn't mind. So there's a good side and bad side to these things, you understand? We're all different. We've all got attachment. So the thing is, when my attachment didn't get what it wanted, I'd get angry. So this is the third of the three. Remember the three toxic emotions? Ego grasping is the root, the primordial assumption of this ridiculous separate me. We're getting to that one. That, on the basis of this, there's attachment to get what that fantasy me wants, which is this emotional hunger, dissatisfaction, manipulating, controlling, to make things the way I want. Attachment does that. That's its job. Now, kind people have it, and so do unkind people. We all have attachment, unless you're a bodhisattva already. So it's harder for you kind people to see your attachment. It's much harder. Are you seeing what I'm saying here?
Yes.
It's easier to see my attachment, because when attachment doesn't get what it wants, it turns into aversion. Now that has got a whole spectrum of responses. The obvious response of aversion is volatile anger, shout, yell. I'm a classic one of those. You might have a kid like that, or yourself. It's obvious, evident. How dare you do that? My attachment doesn't want that, so shout, yell, kick. Now, there's a whole spectrum. Then there's the milder versions of thwarted attachment, aversion, and all of us have these all day. We don't pay attention. They're called irritation, annoyed, upset, frustrated, anxious, worried, stressed. Stress is the interplay between attachment not getting what it wants and aversion rising. This is very subtle. This is a subtle, subtle, all day. Subtle. But we don't go to the therapist and say, oh, I got annoyed today. We wait till we want to kill our husband before we go to the therapist. And that's one of our main problems, I tell you. We don't notice what's happening in here until you want to kill yourself or your boyfriend. Because it continues in this spectrum of aversion all the way to despair and depression. Do you understand? Can you hear me? But it's not our analysis, it's not our culture, it's not our psychology. We don't pay attention to what goes on in here, period. And if we do, it's when the wheels are falling off. That analogy I use is like you've never heard of a mechanic. You've never heard of car repair. You've never heard of maintenance. And I mean it sincerely. And you drive your car till the wheels fall off and you're going at 100 miles an hour. Oh, my wheels are falling off. What will I do? Well, it's a little bit late. Do you get my point? And we know that stupidity. Waiting till your teeth fall out before you go to the dentist. We know we have amazing systems of maintenance of our body, our mouth, our cars, our houses, but not our mind. This is a serious point. I'm not being silly and just cliched. We don't have methods in our culture to pay attention to here. Even our view now of meditation. Let's say I'm in love with whoever I'm in love with. What's your name?
Zach,
I'm sorry, forget. So I'm in love with Zach. We're blissfully happy. And someone says, oh, you know, you should learn to meditate, Rabina. I say, don't be ridiculous, I'm happy. Because we think of meditation as an alternative to a pill. You see my point? Really in our mind we think this. That's like waiting for the wheels to fall off. You've got to start paying attention when there's a slight wobble. Then guess what? When you deal with a wobble and you fix it, the wheels will never fall off. So if you use these practical skills that the Buddha's suggesting of beginning to pay attention to your thoughts, controlling your body and speech, you can really learn very slowly to live your life well and maintain your thoughts, and you could say you would never have a mental breakdown. It's common sense. So you have to recognize, you have to want to do that, and then you have to have the brilliant skill of distinguishing between attachment and love, compassion and anger, because we have these different analyses, you know. So to have this other analysis of Buddha's, and then realize there is an erotic, eye-based, fear-based, demented ones mixed with our virtues. And the irony of that is, the more virtue we have, okay, the less delusions, but we've still got delusions. But they're polluting our virtues, and in a way the virtues make it harder for us to see the delusions. And so because attachment's so subtle, when you're a really nice person, then you wonder why you get used by other people, you get dragged down, you get people use you like a doormat, especially if you become abused in a relationship, you wonder why, because you're a nice person. It's because your attachment is destroying you, and you can't recognize it. You can't distinguish it from the other part. You're yearning all the time, hoping if I do this and do that, mummy will love me. If I do this and do that, he'll love me. That kind of approach. That's because of attachment. We don't notice it. Then when you have aversion, then your style of thwarted attachment is depression. You become quiet or sad, as we say. That's depression. That's the attachment not getting what it wants, so you become depressed. That's what depression is. It's internalized aversion. Person who doesn't who's always disappointed and always getting upset and angry. That's anger. But if you, when things go wrong, get disappointed, get punched in the nose, people go, things go wrong, it builds up, because nothing goes astray. Everything gets built up. So then you go in and down and deep and down to where now you can't get out of bed one morning. Because you're inert. Oh, I'm depressed. What can I do about it? Again, the wheels have fallen off. We have to notice the mind way before that. And this is what's hard for us. Are you with me, people? So understanding ego grasping, which is the root one, we're going to get to that emptiness. But here in daily life, attachment and aversion, and we go between these two 1,000 times a day. So attachment's a junkie, always just wanting nice things. The second it doesn't get it, it's upset, irritated, annoyed, stressed, anxious, worried, angry, depressed, and that builds up. And so one, you can't get out of bed, or two, you want to kill somebody. So we have to notice before it gets to that level. But that's really, really, really hard for us, because we only pay attention when the body is involved, because we are only the body. That's the tragedy. Attachment and aversion. If you can get these two, 90% of your worries, worries, anxiety, panic, stress, they're all mild versions of aversion, of thwarted attachment. Anger is an obvious volatile one, easy to identify. How dare that happen? It's not what my attachment wants, Freak out, shout, yell. That's easy to identify. Simple. But frustrated, annoyed, irritated, stressed, it builds up subtly, all the time, building it, and nothing goes astray. And it builds up, it doesn't go in one ear and out the other. Until you deal with it, it builds up like the wobbly wheels won't suddenly go away. The wobbly wheels will keep being wobbly, and they get more wobbly, and more wobbly. Maybe they're quiet, and then more wobbly, and one day they fall off. And that's when we notice, way too late. That's what we mean by going to a doctor and a therapist. We assume a therapist, we have to do curative. It's preventative. And we can do it. This is the point. And that's why this is the hard job of being a Buddhist. But why you do your prostrations, why you do your water bowls, why you do your mantras, why you do your visualizations, why you do your vows, they are like techniques to help you do this job. Just a bit like I use the analogy, let's say, I always use Michael Jordan as the example. I'm sure he's a grandfather by now, but pretend. I keep using that same example. Or let's say a tennis player. It doesn't matter. Let's say Michael Jordan. You go to the basketball. And you see him whizzing up and down the court, upwards, backwards, there, and now endless balls in the hoop. You're so excited. Oh, Michael, please show me how to get the ball in the hoop. Because, let's face it, that's the essence of basketball, isn't it? The biggest number of balls in the hoop and you win. That's the essence of basketball, in the hoop. That's it, and you're excited. So he says, yeah, Rabina, okay, you've got to go jogging for this at 5 miles a day and do this and live in this diet and go to university and learn basketball, technology and philosophy and do this and do that. And I said, no, Michael, you didn't hear me. How do I get the ball in the hoop? And repeat the answer. Because you can't just walk on the court and get the ball in the hoop. You've got to prime your body and mind for years. And then you'll do it effortlessly. Well, this job of being your own therapist is the same. This is the main job. But we are not ready for it. We can't almost, it's like massively difficult for us. So we have to do the other practices, which are like the push-ups and the good diets, like controlling your body, controlling your speech, living in vows. They support it. They calm your gross level down so your mind can do the job. They support the real job. You don't become a Buddhist until you do this. That's why that story about Atisha. I think it was Atisha. And somebody said to him, I did my prostration today. I'm very happy. I hope you practice Dharma. Oh, okay. I did my meditation. I did my this. I did my circumambulations. I hope you practice Dharma every time. All they mean by practice Dharma is work on your mind. That's the job. From here to Buddhahood, that's the job to be done. Why? Because the end result is sangha, rid of rubbish, full of goodness. It's a psychological job. It's a job of the mind. And all that other stuff supports it, puts atomic bombs on the delusions, so it makes it easier. So doing all your push-ups makes you more fit and healthy so you can get the ball in the hoop. Getting the ball in the hoop is changing your mind. That's being a Buddhist. Why do you have prayer flags? Help you change your mind. Why do you have pictures of Buddha? Help you change your mind. Why do I wear these funny robes and a bald head? Help me change my mind. There's things you do that you use as tools to help you change your mind. That's it. And then you take on board all these things as and when you're ready. You're the boss. Are we communicating? 10 to 3. So now, this is high school. So what you get from this and junior school is what they call renunciation. This is the wisdom wing. So if you've got to complete the wisdom wing, you're on the Theravadin path, you'll continue this work, and you'll get to the root of the problem, and you'll uproot ego grasping, you'll realize emptiness, you'll perfect it life after life, and then one life or other, you'll completely achieve your nirvana, and the end of that life, you're out of here. You're gone. You're finished. You've done the job. You've achieved your own liberation from suffering and its causes. That is one goal. That's high school. But we're on the Mahayana path, so you can go further. Okay? You can go further. So let's talk about going further, because this is the tradition we're learning here. So as far as here, you'd say, you might have realized emptiness by now, but that's not the issue. Mainly what you get from this work of controlling your body, your speech, living in vows, doing all your purification practices and lots of other things, and working on your mind and lessening delusions and understanding, realizing the virtues, and mainly this work is refraining from harming with your body, speech and mind, working on giving up delusions, lessening the power of delusions, lessening the power of your body and speech. It's mainly that kind of main, and you are the beneficiary of this. It's for your sake. And from this, you have realized what they call renunciation. What are you renouncing? What are you giving up? Suffering and its causes. First Noble Truth, we mentioned two kinds of suffering. Let me go back to the first one. First kind of suffering, you're giving up the gross level. So you stop getting harmed. You practice junior school. You want to give up the second level, which is the suffering of change, which comes from attachment, so you give up the delusions. That's the more powerful one. So by this point, you've got renunciation. You've understood suffering and its causes, and you're up to here with it, and you're sick of it. That's renunciation. So the sign of having renunciation, Lama Zopa says, you've got it when just the thought of another moment of attachment is so repulsive. It's like being in a septic tank. So way to go, okay? Way to go. And how would you be? It sounds very forbidding to give up this and give up that. It always sounds depressing to us. So now how would you be? You'd be blissful. You'd be stable. You'd have immense equanimity. You'd have less neuroses. You'd be less up and down. You'd be less ridiculous. You'd be less jealous. You'd be less angry. You'd be less proud. You'd be less low self-esteem. You'd be more steady, more calm, more wise, and more joyful. More happy, in other words. Very simple. Happy and confident and courageous. You'd be a wonderful person. So now, that's renunciation. We can go further. We can go to the next wing of the bird, compassion wing, the bodhisattva path, or if you like, university level. And continue the job of working on your mind. It doesn't change. No difference. But now, before, it was in reference to making sure you don't hurt others for your sake. Now it's in reference to how to break down the barriers that these delusions have created, the barriers that our delusions have created between self and other. So in order to rip them down, in order to get closer to others, in order to help others. This is the compassion wing. Same job, work on your mind, but in reference to sentient beings. This is all... These two levels are all framed in terms of the two levels of vows. The first level of vows is what they call individual liberation. The vows that help me get my liberation. So I don't kill, don't steal, don't this, don't that. Monks and nun vows are the same level. It's got a few more, that's all, but they're the same purpose. To harness our body and speech. Vows are about behavior. Then we can work on our mind and get renunciation and become this blissful, wonderful, happy person. But we know suffering and its causes, and this is, which means we understand karma and we understand the delusions. We've got this down. First and second truths. We've got them down. This is profound already. So this is the basis now for moving on to the compassion wing, where we're trying to cultivate compassion for others, which is, oh my God, look at the suffering. But what suffering? We've learned that in high school. There are three levels, remember? We've done the first and second. So when we see other sentient beings, we see the ones who are suffering. That's the first kind of suffering. We have compassion for them, and that's the usual compassion we have. But now we've got compassion for all the others. Because we see their attachment, and we see their jealousy, we see their psychosis, we see they want to rape and kill and torture, but we know why they're suffering, we know why they do it, so now we're capable of having compassion for them easily. And yes, you'll have compassion for Mr. Trump. Yes, at that level, you will. But you understand my point? You get it. But that, see, what we think of compassion, we conflate it with, oh, the poor things can't help it. They have to be innocent victims. We only like to have compassion for innocent victims. But here it's way more powerful. Our compassion is kind of vindictive. You'd better deserve my compassion, baby. You've got to be a saint. Then I'm prepared to have compassion for you. That's heavy duty. This is, we're all in the same boat. Oh my God, you know. I mean, you see, so this is where you practice the wisdom wing. I find it very profound. So I use Mr. Trump as an example. First of all, we don't know if he's not a bodhisattva, and I'm not being hilarious. You don't know who anybody is, so don't judge. And you only really get to know that when you start the bodhisattva path, which we're going to talk about a bit. We're okay. So, at the first level, how you practice the wisdom wing by looking at the world, not the compassion wing, the wisdom wing. This is powerful. All of it is grist for your mill. So when I open up my iPad and I read my Financial Times, my New York Times, my New Yorker, my Vanity Fair, my Vogue, I'm a junkie for magazines, okay? You can tell I'm old because I buy subscriptions to magazines and newspapers, you know, not look on the internet ones. I wouldn't have a clue about all those ones. So, I mean, you know, I read all these things. And so, of course, everybody's obsessed with Mr. Trump. Every heading in the New York Times is Mr. Trump. There'll be no news these days without Mr. Trump. You're bored if there's no Mr. Trump news. It's very fascinating. So how do you deal? So right now, being an ordinary deluded person, how do we deal with it? Oh my God, look at that monster. How dare he do this? Look at these evil people. Look at that monstrous war. We live in negativity all day. Because that's our response to seeing people harming others. We have compassion for the people, but we'll get really angry because we believe they're the cause of it. That's the logic we use in our culture. So we just destroy ourselves. We're exhausted. So what's this approach here? It's really clear. The wisdom wing approach is marvelous. All of that out there is like workshop for you to see suffering. So, you know, when I read about Mr. Trump, it's perfect. I say to myself, either one or the other, or anything else I read. I use my analysis about karma, delusions, which I'm using for myself, and I apply it to him. And I'll go, either I'll go, I recognize that. When I see him lie, I recognize that. When I see him attachment to food, I recognize that. When I don't want to grab ladies, you know what, but you understand, but sexual attachment, I recognize that. Or arrogance, I absolutely recognize that. You know, manipulating people, abusive speech, I recognize every one of those. Do we not recognize these in ourselves? This is how you learn. And then the second one you say is, thank you for showing me how not to be. Then in that way, you can use the whole world as this amazing workshop to help you realize, wow, I'd better keep practicing. Even when you see wars, then your heart breaks. You see this war, there's a bunch of people killed. My God, look at the result of karma. Then you see the people doing it to them. Oh my God, look what they're doing, creating monstrous suffering for themselves for the future. So you use the analysis of karma and the analysis of the mind, and everything in life is like this workshop. Then you get courage and strength from it. Not exhausted, not drained, not angry, not fearful, not panic-stricken. That's just a wisdom wing. Now the compassion wing, as we progress, your analysis is, oh my God, look at these sentient beings suffering. I've said that one. And look at the ones causing suffering. And then this brings you the courageous attitude of the bodhisattva is that it's my job to help sentient beings. Like the job of a mother. This is a really good example. A mother, she's in the beach and her kid is drowning. She will have unbelievable compassion, guaranteed. And compassion is seeing the suffering of another and empathizing with it. But she won't sit there wondering who will save her baby. Even if she can't swim, she leaps in. That's great compassion. That's what Martin Luther King said. You see bad things out there, and then you say, what can I do to help? That's called great compassion, maha karuna. It's a technical term. Not just, oh my God, look at that suffering, and walk away, or get depressed. But that's the bodhisattva one. They go to the next step where they say, if I don't do it, who will? You take this sense of incredible responsibility, and that's coming from courage, not attachment. And you develop this courageous attitude of the bodhisattva that it's my job to make it happen. Of course, incremental, one step at a time. do what you can. But that's the attitude that impels the bodhisattva to keep growing, keep ripping the delusions out, keep wanting to grow this compassion, to great compassion, which then culminates in bodhicitta. The aspiration, got two parts. One, the aspiration to never stop helping whoever is in front of you. Ant, dog, the person, the pedophile, whoever. You do, based on wisdom, you do what's necessary to help them. And then second aspiration of the bodhisattva, the long-term one, I will never stop working on myself, perfecting myself, so I can become a Buddha. That's the two components of bodhicitta. This paradigm shift that will happen in the mind on the basis of equanimity, all those different steps, 11 little steps that culminate in that bodhicitta. That's the essence of the compassion wing, very quickly. Huge attitude, brave attitude. And the point is, this is the point, somebody said a few days ago, that people who are bodhisattvas are also blissfully happy. There's no contradiction. Look at the Dalai Lama. Don't put him in the sky. He's on the earth like us, and he's forcing us to make sure we see him as an ordinary person, which is so important. What that means is, look at how his behavior is for 60 years. Look at his suffering. Look at his people. 1 million, 2 million Tibetans of the 6 million in the beginning, killed, country completely destroyed, there's nothing left. Every element, every mineral, everything has been ripped to pieces, destroyed. The country has been destroyed. All the wildlife, no longer any there. It's just destroyed. It's heartbreaking. That's his country. He's like their mother. But you can see, for 60 years, he doesn't get angry. He cracks jokes. He's fierce. He's powerful, he's charismatic, he's action-oriented, super powerful person. Clear as anything, incredible wisdom, incredible joy, he's laughing all the time, funny, cracks jokes about his enemies, he's not distressed, this is 60 years later, he's 80-something now. And he never gives up, spiritually, politically, diplomatically, scientifically, psychologically, socially, every method, he has the attitude of the bodhisattva. They think in terms of eons. They've got this immense courage based upon great compassion, based upon the fact that your mind will never end anyway. And because he's done the job of ridding all the delusions from his mind, he's no longer suffering. In that sense, you could argue he does not suffer. Suffering in Buddhism is coming from delusions, not from compassion. Compassion has got nothing to do with you suffering. You do not suffer when you see other people suffering if you have compassion. It's impossible. You only suffer because you have attachment or anger. This is crucial to understand. Compassion does not bring suffering. It brings more compassion. It brings more energy to want to help, more enthusiasm, more, not joy because your heart is broken, but you want to help. So you keep developing your wisdom and your ability to help and never give up. Suffering comes from delusions. They drag us down to hell. Are we communicating? I'm sure I am. So then, get to bodhicitta. I whizzed through that bit. Very quick, wasn't it? 2 days was the wisdom week, but that's when the nuts and bolts are. Now we whizzed through the compassion, we've got bodhicitta. Now we go to the final stages of a bodhisattva path. And we practice the 6 perfections. We perfect the 2 wings of the bird. The first 4, where we perfect the compassion wing and the in relation to sentient beings, bopping around life after life after life. And the last 2, we perfect the wisdom wing with single point of concentration, shamatha, and special insight, vipassana. The first 4 are the practice of generosity, morality, patience, and perseverance. Let's go through these briefly. First is morality. The whole path is morality. The whole path is ethics. But there's a crucial difference here. In the first stages in junior school and high school, first and second scopes, it's the ethics or the morality of restraint, of refraining from harming, of harnessing your body, speech and mind, of not harming, of lessen delusions. This is powerful work. That's the wisdom wing. The morality of restraint. The morality of refraining from negative actions of body, speech, and mind. Why? Because that stops your suffering. Now, we continue on the bodhisattva path, the practice of ethics, but now it's in reference to helping others, because we're now qualified. So on the first perfection is our, the practice of, not morality, the second one. The first one's generosity. It sounds kind of cute, generosity. Well, Tsongkhapa says in these six perfections, in one of his wonderful verse, kind of, it's called the Song Hymns of Experience, he talks about generosity, the first perfection. Generosity is a wish-fulfilling jewel with which you can fulfill the hopes of all sentient beings. It's the start of this process. It's the basis of the activity of the bodhisattvas in that it develops a selflessness and undaunted courage to want to benefit all sentient beings. So giving is powerful. Giving is already removing, get yourself out of the equation, you know? Wanting to give. Give what? The first level, give things. Give material things. What do? You give what to whom? What people need. Well, you know, we can give anything. So one of our measures in our life of things we know is called money, and that's a very powerful measure. It's a massive one for us. So in general, we don't like to give. It's an automatic assumption. It's an instinctive assumption. So here we're trying to do the reverse. One time as Lama Zopa says, do not think of giving. Sorry, do not think of receiving. Think of giving. So we're trying to cultivate the bodhisattva attitude that reverses the normal one. As Milarepa says, Dharma in general is the exact opposite of the world. So the instinctive one for us, because we have attachment, is we want to have things, want praise, want gifts. Nothing wrong, it's okay, but it's attachment. You know, the first instinct isn't to want to give. And this is our beloveds, of course, and want praise in return. So here we practice, at the first level, wanting to give things. So clearly, money is a great measure of things. We know that. It's the one we use. We don't barter kilos of rice or bulls here now. We use greenbacks. Or prettier money in most countries, I read about. Most countries have really pretty money, you know. Pretty colours and everything. But American money is very steady. It's all the same size. It's got different numbers, you know. And different people, hasn't it? Anyway, whatever. So giving money. And we don't like it much. But we always feel it, because we always feel we haven't got enough, you know. So if I give, we think we'll even have less. But we understand the karma of giving. This is very fascinating, this. The main causes of our having the life that we've got, meaning not born in a country where you have no money, not born in a poor place where you can't get a job, we have to work 18 hours a day to survive, which many Americans have to do, at $7.50 an hour federal, isn't it? $7.50 is the federal... Oh, I beg your pardon, 725. I mean, listen to this, it's very fascinating. I lived in New York City for 1 year in 1974. I got $3 an hour for working for Manpower as a typist. And I paid $100 a month rent. I probably get $9 an hour now and pay $2,000 of rent. Something's wrong, isn't it? Something's a bit wrong there. That's fascinating, isn't it? Anyway, never mind, this is politics. I don't want to get into politics. Apparently in Australia, I'm just trying to show off because I'm American as well, it's like nearly $20 an hour. The federal basic wage is $20 an hour or something. And we get free medical. And if I go back home tomorrow and I'm Australian, I'll get $2,000 pension a month. I told somebody, I said, they really like, you said it, where are you? You said, are you socialist in Australia? There, you said it. She's been brainwashed by American politics. No, I said, but they're even more conservative government than America. But they're just used to taking care of their people, that's all. It's been a habit in Australia for like 50 years. We've gotten used to it, you know. Anyway, never mind. I'm also an American, so it's okay. I'm not criticising. I'm also British. And I told you, when I went for my American passport, I will tell you that. And I said, can I keep my other passports? She said, we don't mind how many passports you have, as long as you have allegiance for the United States. So I've got to feel like an American. I feel like a universalist. It's okay. So shut up. Where was I? Generosity. Okay, giving. So we, as Rinpoche says, don't think of receiving. But this is powerful. Think of your mind. It's not automatic unless it's your beloved friend. Or unless you get praise for it. Unless we get a tax break. And it's okay to get a tax break. Nothing wrong. But, you know, we have to practice this. It's natural. But the point is this. Just to get the life we've got, being 1% of the world, fortunate. One, the cause of getting a human mother was non-killing. The cause of having things, being born where you can get a job, get money, get food, get a loan, that's the fruit of generosity. That's the fruit of generosity. Conscious act of generosity. Of things, not of bananas. When a poor person wants $10, maybe give you a banana, that's okay. But give them what they want, which is called dollars. It's a very powerful one, you know, thinking of it like this. It's a really powerful one, that. We don't like giving homeless people money. In India, it's accepted, although it's a bit rampant, crazy kind of system. When, you know, people sell their, you know, drug their babies. I mean, it's going to happen. It's bound to happen everywhere. But somehow, the one of us wanting to give money to somebody who doesn't have money is very hard for some reason. I don't know why it is. It's so fascinating. You know, you go into Starbucks and you pay, what is it, $10 for your coffee and your cookie. But listen to this. This is really practical. Because we respect commerce. But we know if we did our analysis that probably, I don't know, 30%? How much profit? I don't know how much profit. Let's pretend 30%. We know that we pay for our coffee, we pay for our cooking, we pay the salaries, we pay the rent, and we give a donation of 30%. But we don't mind because we're used to commerce. But to give 30% equal of $3 to the person outside the door, no, sorry. Because you get nothing in return. We're just used to that. We're how we are. So we've got to do this analysis. Think about it. Think about our mind wanting to give. And give it not the big grand, big fancy level. Give it the level we can. You know, person looking in their purse for their change, give them 5 cents. I mean, we don't even think of doing this. We do sometimes. But it's just a simple example. Practice the attitude of wanting to give. Not to show off, not to be seen as a fancy person, but just changing our thoughts, you know. Because we're very instinctive that we haven't got enough. Even if we've got quite well off, we don't think we have enough. We don't like to give, even though we do have lots of money in the bank and a good pension plan, and we know even if we do that calculation, we find till we die, we don't like giving the extra bits. We just don't like it. We like seeing it there in the money, in the bank. We like that. That makes us happy. Phew, I've got some in the bank, you know, or some in the insurance policy, or some whatever you have, your 501c3. No, wrong one. 401k. What is it called? Yeah. That one, yes. In Australia, they call it super. It's called your superannuation. That's what they call your pension plan, you know. So you're saving your super, they say. So practicing trying to give. It's a very simple word. It's a very simple concept. That's the first kind. And it's meant to be the easiest. The second kind is giving advice. That's easy for us. We love giving advice. Spiritual advice, of course. That's easy, easy, easy. We love giving spiritual advice, even when we're not asked. So we should practice the first one more, I'd say. And shut our mouths, you know. The third one's called giving protection. It's very curious. Releasing people from prison, saving animals' lives. That's called giving. It's curious, isn't it? That's just brief. Next one, morality, the one of benefiting others. That's pretty evident. Practicing thinking. See, the bodhisattva, it's like their job description. This is already when you've achieved bodhicitta. We're just going through the steps. This is already phenomenal. This is already outrageous. And they're perfecting all of these in relation to sentient beings life after life. Perfecting, perfecting, perfecting. But it's an ongoing process, you see. So morality is helping whoever needs to be helped. But practicing, what we can do is practice thinking, what can I do to help? Practice thinking, what do people need? How can I give it? Not to show off and be fancy, look at me giving, look at me practicing. No, no, no. It's changing the mind. What can I do? What can I give? Someone needs something, you read about it, you think, oh, I must give that. This is profound, this is practicing, training our minds to think this way. Powerful, very powerful. Start with the mind. Your hand won't go in your pocket, I promise, until your thought says, I will give. Believe me, your hand does not have its own brain. The next one is patience, which is like a dirty word for us. Already in the compassion wing, and I didn't go any into this at all, it's really a cut right across, we had no time, about achieving these steps going up to bodhicitta. Unbelievable, the whole level of practice called exchanging self for others. That's all where that comes. Unbelievably profound level of practice where you really try to smash ego. This is a very intense level. And it's called transforming problems into happiness, exchanging self for others. And that's what a bodhicitta is. You make this paradigm shift when our others are more important than you. But even these words for us are hard to hear. That assumes a person who's gone beyond ego. Even that's bizarre for us. So this is already outrageous. We cut right across that. We didn't even get into it. But patience coming here is an extra level of long-term patience. So patience is actually a profound state of mind that attacks aversion. Attachment's still there. The assumption is even though you're a bodhisattva, you hardly realize, but let's talk at our level. Attachment always wants what it wants. It always wants what it wants, which means it wants what I want, which means it wants what I think is good, which means it, you know, forget you. It's always, if it's in sync with you, we're fine. If not, then sorry, you know. So patience is what will kick in the millisecond attachment is thwarted. And because this happens so fast, and the bodhisattva level, it's easy, it's what kicks in the second you don't get what you want. The toilet seat up instead of down. The traffic lights are not the right colour. The noise a little bit loud. These are baby examples. Patience is what kicks in right there that counteracts aversion. Aversion is a normal one that arises without even any volition, because we're so trained. That's anger. But here, patience is the antidote. So patience is like a brave attitude that welcomes the problem. Bring it on, baby. That's what patience is. It's a huge, advanced, brave state of mind. It's like an atomic bomb. But you've got to catch the attachment, not getting what he wants, don't you? That shows already so much awareness of your mind. So just that's practicing patience. Whereas we think of patience as like, what do we call it? We call it passive aggression. Gritting your teeth and waiting for a horrible thing to go away. That's not patience. That's internalized aversion. Do you understand? Patience is a powerful view that and even as they say, and this is getting close to emptiness now, which we're now getting to, this is where you apply emptiness already. Even in transforming problems, back before you get bodhicitta, transforming a problem is literally, and this is what patience is, it's normal view with attachment and aversion. A problem is what attachment doesn't want. A problem is what you don't want. So, you know, if you like chocolate cake, carrot cake's a problem. You understand my point? That's right there, isn't it? So simple. Carrot cake's the problem. So when you catch your mind having aversion the moment what you wanted doesn't come, this is a tiny example. Baby, start with the baby ones. Then you grow, get better. Start with that. That second, as a practice. You could easily go and say, no, I ordered chocolate cake. Nothing wrong. But if you want to practice, a moment of practice, welcome the carrot cake. This is great. I can enjoy carrot cake. That's the practice of patience. In other words, it's also emptiness. It's proving that you could, if you call it good, it becomes good. But when the mind is stubborn, which the mind is when it's deluded, it will call carrot cake bad and it will never change. It is bad. Do you get my point? Patience is profound. It sees it as good, which already is implying emptiness. Because we're getting to emptiness now. Nearly, almost there, two more steps. But this is implying it already. It's already implying it. Because the ultimate way of understanding things is that nothing has an intrinsic nature in itself. It's what we call it. We give the meaning to things. That's the final meaning of emptiness. But we'll go through some stages of it, you know. This is just brilliant. When our minds can be so flexible. This doesn't mean you give up and say, let the person kick the dog. I'm seeing it as good. Don't be stupid. No. Someone's harming somebody, so you do what you can. You know? Of course, that's different. But in the way that I don't get what I want. Patience is the absolute... Tsongkhapa says it's the... what's he say? I forget. Something or other. I forget something. It's like... it's the opposite. It's a profound antidote. But you've got to catch. You've got to even see the attachment not getting what it wants. So, of course, the way they present it in the text, there's three levels of patience. Patience in the face of abuse. They're uncompromising how they put it. Heavy duty when someone's mean to you. That's the main suffering. Of course it is. That's the experiences similar to the cause. The third level of karma, where people are mean to us. This is the pain we can't bear. Toilet seat is an example of that because he did it, you know. That red light, how dare. That cake, I ordered chocolate cake. It's always about people. So in the end, this one is, you know, so powerful, you know. Because the one of emptiness is, anyway, so the fourth one, we'll go to the fourth, no time now. Fourth one of the perfections, and this is very fascinating. It's called joyful effort. Enthusiastic perseverance. It sounds ridiculous, right? What's that? Well, you will hear what it is, and it's embarrassing when you hear the opposite. And the opposite is called laziness. And there are three kinds. And we'll recognize them. Everyone will be embarrassed. The first kind of laziness is can't be bothered, which is the typical one. So what can't you be bothered doing? It's logic. The thing that takes effort. And what's the thing that takes effort? The thing that attachment doesn't want. So basically we're junkies to stay in our comfort zone. And this is why if we have a pleasant house and pleasant family and pleasant surroundings, the hardest thing to do is make effort because everything's so pleasant. And we just love, nothing wrong with comfort, nothing wrong with it, but we know to move one inch forward in learning anything, you've got to push beyond your comfort zone. It's logical. We know this is scientific truth. Even to do push-ups, you go to the gym, oh, I did my push-ups today, darling. No, you didn't, if you stopped the second it got painful. Nothing will change. We know the muscles won't change until you go beyond the hurt. We kind of know that. This is the thing. But what we're talking here is practicing virtue and giving up practicing non-virtue. This is profound, I tell you. And that's just the grossest one, the most obvious kind of laziness, the worst that everybody has. Now the next one is a lie and is our own propaganda and we think it's a virtue. And the next one is, oh no, I'm too busy. I'll do it later. And what is it you're too busy to do? The thing that takes too much effort. But you kind of add this extra lie to it to make you feel good, to get off the hook, I'll do it later. And we know as we say it, you feel relief. Oh, phew, I'll do it later. It's okay, I'll do it later. But we know later never comes. We know that. And you know, this is one of the worst regrets of all these things. I'll tell you that in a minute. I'll tell you in a second. This we really recognize, and it's just the gross laziness with an extra piece on top. And it's more tricky because we think we're being so holy. I'm so busy. I'll do it later. So the way to think this one, we've got to be much more brutal and clear with ourselves. We've got to... Everybody's busy, right? Everyone's got jobs. Everyone's got responsibilities. This is our life now. But the first one, like let's say you've been to a retreat and you're all excited, you come home, you're going to do your practice every morning. You decide you're going to do your practice every morning. So then you start on the first morning, you're all excited. You do your practice, hop out of bed, do your practice, because you prioritize it. Next morning you get out of bed. Third morning, suddenly you feel, oh, I can't be bothered. It all happens in a millisecond. Oh, I can't be bothered. And then you say, oh, you feel a bit guilty. Then you go, oh no, phew, I'll do it later. So you hop out of bed, you go to your breakfast, you do this, and already it's in the back of your mind. I'll do it later. And so you put it off. We recognize this. This is our worst crime against ourselves. And not to be bad about it, because it's a very deep addiction, because we're addicted to comfort, addicted to our attachment, addicted to not making an effort. And because our lives are so nice, I mean, I saw when we did the Lado trek, 3 years now, and I analyzed it and I realized how it was tough. But it was only tough because attachment didn't get what it wanted. You got to push your body and you're up there for 4 or 5 days in 10 below with clothing, layers upon layers because you don't have any heating except in the dining room where there's a nice fire. So you're mostly freezing cold. So you're miserable. That's all because attachment's not getting what it wants. It's very simple. It's really nothing. I mean, they all live up there all their lives. They're not complaining because they're used to it. But for us, we're used to pressing the button, getting the right temperature, you know. So it's hard work. Only because we're not getting what attachment wants. Very simple. This is laziness. So but the point is, forget about spiritual practice. We get this really powerfully. We know to succeed in anything at all, we absolutely have to make effort. It's just, make effort means going beyond that moment where... Because nothing will change. Your muscles won't change. Nothing will change until you make effort. If you have to learn to play the piano, nothing will change until you make the effort to memorize it and get past that inertia of can't be bothered. Too much effort. I'll do it later. You've got to have this enormous courage and perseverance. And that's just in ordinary samsaric activities. So here we're talking practice. Now the thing is, all the lamas say... The only time you'll ever really do something with enthusiasm is when you know the benefits. So we know the benefits of having a healthy body. We know the benefits. Keep it simple. We know the benefits of having money. Forget even a healthy body. That's too much effort. We know the benefits of tasting food. We know the benefits of pleasant weather. We know the benefits of a cozy bed. In other words, we know the benefits of those things. We know the benefits of following attachment. We know them because attachment gets what it wants. Just talking ordinary samsara. So then that's why we always do them. That's why we always prioritize them. We use our intelligence and we prioritize those things. So we know the benefit of a good reputation. So when you wake up in the morning, you don't go and do your practice and then go, oh, I forget taking the curlers. Okay, no one has curlers in their hair anymore. I'll leave the curlers in. That won't matter. I'm too busy because I did my practice. We don't say that. Oh, I'm too busy to have a shower, so you wear and go with your smelly body. No, no, no. Oh, I'm too busy to have breakfast. No, no, no. We're just too busy to think about 2 days to do. But we make it sound like virtue. And there's always a mean example I use. But it's a really good one. A friend of mine in Sydney lived like 30 kilometres, 20 miles from the centre. No, I didn't expect her to go. But she always apologised for not going, oh, I'm so busy, too much to the kids, this, that. And I never expected her to go, but she always apologised. Like, guilty. I'm too busy, she said. And I was naughty. And I said, if there's a cheque for $500 at the centre for you, would you go and get it? Of course she would. Even though she's not that poor, we all know the virtue. Simple. We know the benefit of a $500 check. So that she'd hop the kids in the back of the car. Come on, kids. We go with a happy mind, drive 30 kilometres, and come back and keep on carrying your life. You prioritise it. So we have to prioritise. We have to not lie to ourselves. This is the point. We have to do that job. We have to prioritise. And we have to be very... The commonest thing we say is, oh, I had to not do... I was going to be too... We lie to ourselves. We've got to be very rigorous and truthful with our own minds. Not to be brutal, just to be truthful. Because we've got to be our own boss. But it's a very strong habit to give up because we're addicted to the pleasure that comes from attachment, getting what we think we want. And especially if that thing's extra addictive. Certain activities are very addictive, like our iPhones and our reading the news or doing video games, this kind of thing, they're very addictive. So these are things that will destroy us because they have the character of being addictive. And that's why most of us put things off, you know, not just sleep and being comfortable in our sofa. So we've got to think about this. The third kind of laziness sounds very strange initially. It's the one that says, no, 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 I can't achieve that. That's not possible. No, no, I can't achieve that. That's what keeps us in our comfort zone, and we'll never achieve anything until we have the courage and the confidence to know, even though it's a long way off, you know it's possible. So here, when we understand Buddha nature, when we understand delusions aren't fixed, when we understand bodhicitta, all these things which seem so distant, we don't just go, oh, no, I can't be bothered. Because when you say, I can't be bothered, you won't take the first step. But when you know it's possible, you'll take the first step. And we all know those sayings, Rome wasn't built in a day, one step at a time, pave the way. These are profound statements. They're all laziness, and they are why we don't succeed. So we've got to go one step at a time with clarity and sincerity. You understand, people? So the next two perfections, this is the first four, we perfect our compassion wing. Now the last two are we perfect the wisdom wing. And this is where we put, these two are the first kind of meditation in Buddhism, shamatha, we gain single-pointed concentration, calm abiding. And the second one, on the basis of success at the first, we use that single-pointedness in the second mode of meditation where we develop insight into reality. So insight in general can be insight into everything. These two modes of meditation, you can use them to get insight into karma, insight into impermanence, insight into everything we're talking about. In fact, you would do that. But here, specifically in the six perfections, it's insight into into wisdom, into how things exist ultimately. So all the work of learning about karma and all the work of learning about our mind, these are preparing us for this. It's not like a separate thing. It all leads to this. So what does this mean? Well, first of all, we learned in high school that all the delusions have the particular function of distorting. Attachment over-exaggerates the deliciousness of fishing or the chocolate cake such that you don't see the reality that's there. So Buddha in general is telling us that all these neuroses in our mind, all the gross ones down to the most subtle, ego grasping, their one job that they all have is to exaggerate, is to not see reality as it is. This is a real meaning in Buddhism. So when we learn about the mind and attachment and aversion, we're learning that. So now we're prepared to go to the root delusion of those three, ego grasping, which is the most subtle, most primordial, the main mistake, such that when that's uprooted, we begin our process of getting out of samsara, into nirvana. So, okay. What? Huh? What? What about? Which question? Well, not much time. What about?
Before we start the emptiness part, when you are working with, like, detecting the agreements or beliefs,
I don't know how to put it.
In the wisdom part, when you are noticing
your mind,
your thoughts,
your mind, yeah, that's
okay.
Right, exactly.
You know, you notice the feeling first, aversion,
well,
or a little.
No, that's too late. No. That's the wheel falling off. We're trying to notice them before the wheels fall off.
Not when the wheel is falling off.
You just said you notice the emotion. That's the wheels falling off. The emotion when the body is there is the wheels falling off. We have to learn to see it sooner. Even sooner.
Right.
Even sooner.
When you notice them sooner.
Your thoughts.
Yes, you're not
upset. You hear the angry story chatting
away. Exactly. You are not getting upset or you're not getting anxious. You're just noticing the thought. Okay, so when you notice the thought, you question that.
No, you just listen to it and hear what it's saying, then see if it's true.
Right.
Then you argue with it. That's the simplest way of putting it.
Right. So once you do that...
Yeah.
Then it just disappears.
Not always. It depends how strong it is. You might work for years on it. It doesn't go overnight.
Right.
But that's the process. You argue.
Yeah.
You don't let it sit there and fester. The virtues in you argue with the non-virtues, speaking very simply.
Yes. I mean, I'm noticing.
And that then subdues them.
Yes.
If I'm angry with you, let's say you were mean to me, a little bit on the telephone, a little bit, you didn't listen to me perfectly, let's say.
Yes.
And I'm a bit upset. I'm thinking about it. And then I think, well, shut up, Rabina. That's anger. That's ridiculous. You're over-exaggerating her meanness. She just was distracted or something. And it's only because you're attached to what you want. So be quiet. That's it. Done. When it's little, when it's raging strong, it's much harder work because it's been there for so long. And some of our stuff is old habits.
Yeah, so when you're in the part where they're little, you're applying the same antidote or technique of questioning. You know, it's as simple as that. You question or you argue
you
with it.
You listen to what it's saying.
Yeah, you listen to what it says.
Then you argue with it.
Exactly. You argue. That's what I mean by questioning.
Okay.
Then it just...
Then
poof.
No. Depends on how strong the habit is.
I know.
So let's say you're an alcoholic.
Right.
And you're at the moment, you're on the street and you're alcoholic. You've got a long way to go before it just is woof. You've got to start somewhere.
Yes.
So, and some of the habits are strong, is what I'm saying.
Yes, so... At some point, it just poofs.
No, eventually, when you've got concentration, most of us won't go and get that. But if, I'm just saying, if you go and get single point of concentration, you have complete and utter and effortless control over every single thought. That's what we're capable of.
Yes.
Most of us won't get that.
Right.
But we can just do the best we can with the chaos in here and learning to become more familiar every second. So put it this way, the moment we think of learning piano, we've got ignorance. This is a really important point. We have ignorance of piano, haven't we?
Yes.
And it's easy to learn piano, then you just do the right piano. But the Buddha's saying this ignorance we have got is we've been playing piano wrong for 1,000 years.
Yes.
So we've got to unlearn the mistakes and then learn the right method.
Yes.
So here we've got to unlearn anger and unlearn attachment and unlearn ego grasping. This is powerful. So this just takes time.
Yes.
So you're chipping away a tiny bit, one step at a time, and the habits get a little bit weaker and a little bit weaker and a little bit weaker.
Yes.
It's a lifelong job.
Yes.
So question?
The question is, do we substitute...
Yeah, with virtue. Virtue takes over.
With virtue.
That's right. Every time I argue with my anger about you, what am I developing? Called patience. And therefore kindness.
Yes.
And therefore, hi darling,
so
how
you
are you?
You use...
Your virtues.
Ethics.
Yes.
And morality.
Good, that's right. All your good
stuff. Counteract.
That's right. Yes.
The inner...
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And going a little bit more up there or down there or whatever... Okay, so you just continue to use morality.
And getting better and better and better. You're developing new habits. Habit of patience, habit of contentment, habit of not eating 7 pieces of cake, habit of not shouting at people, habit of changing your thoughts. It's like getting better at piano, better at mathematics. It just works incrementally, one baby step at a time.
So the label we're labeling different.
That's getting to emptiness.
We're labeling different.
That's also part of the process. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You understand. It's very good. So now, okay. So one really excellent way to frame the framework for understanding how things exist ultimately is to see it in the context of how things exist conventionally. And there's a very specific definition. So many of these words, we have to learn the definition. If we're talking computer science here, believe me, the moment I start hearing it, I haven't learned the definitions. So our trouble is, oh, that's too high. No, it's not. Learn the definitions and you'll understand it. It just means learning the definitions and getting your head around it. That's all we have to do. First is the intellectual process. So what are these what are we discussing here? The Buddha's saying, at the moment, with his ego grasping, the colloquial term for ignorance, the root delusion, which gives rise to attachment, aversion, all the other millions of them, they all see things wrongly. We don't see things as they exist. It's a very simple statement. But because we're so used to these views, we don't notice. But we have to begin to, attachment exaggerates the deliciousness, aversion exaggerates the badness, you know, jealousy exaggerates this, pride exaggerates that, low self-esteem exaggerates. So we're always living in this fantasy land, believing that this is what is true, and then we get disappointment. So we're up and down like yo-yos, we're all berserk, you know, up and down, there's no stability. And we believe in our stories, and then we hold on to our stories. Like I said before at the very beginning, these conceptions, we have conceptions in the mind. Some are valid and some are not. We're looking at the ones that aren't valid. We're looking at the ones that aren't a valid assessment of reality. Attachment lies because the cake it sees, the attachment in my mind, okay, my glasses, my attachment glasses, I'm seeing cake through my lenses and that cake on that plate looks divine. We know that. And this is just, attachment makes it look delicious. But then the deeper thing here that's happening with ego grasping, we think it's delicious in itself. We think the cake is intrinsically delicious. But let me just go through this step at a time. So we have, there's millions and millions of phenomena that exist in the universe. When you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn the different terms. Phenomenon, object, existent, all these different terms for that which exists. Different synonyms. So Buddha's saying we are seeing all these phenomena wrongly. We see them through the lenses of all our nonsense. So we're living in la-la land, and that's what perpetuates our suffering, life after life after life, programming our mind with rubbish. So here, then if we're seeing everything wrongly, the first thing we have to do is, if we're going to analyze how things exist, we've got to first establish, even conventionally, what does exist. So we use a simple example of a cup, like I said before. We've got to all be on the same page. If we're going to discuss how it exists, we've got to be on the same page. If we, you know, usually with cups we do. But if I say, I love you, and you say, oh, and I love you, we think we're communicating. But if Zach writes down his analysis and his description and his expectations of love, and I write down mine, no wonder we fight. So we don't do any analysis and clarity with this stuff. Up here we might, you know. So anyway, we have to establish what is a cup. An established base is one of the synonyms of that which exists. It's very powerful. So what is it, Mummy? It's a cup. What's a cup? She gives you the definition. Two parts. First, its conventional characteristics. The flat-bottomed clay container. That tells you its conventional characteristics. We're getting there. Not complete yet. I want to know, and this is a huge meaning in understanding emptiness. It might be evident in the beginning, but as we learn it, we'll see. What's its function? What's its job? What does it do? Even more simply, what's its meaning? Oh, it holds my tea, she'll tell me. Well, that's the definition. A flat-bottom clay container, its conventional characteristics, its job, it holds my tea. Now that part's the massive part. It is a thing that holds tea. That's the meaning of it. That's the function of it. That's the job of it. That's what we see when we see it. That's conventionally true. But still, don't believe your mother. Don't just believe what she tells you. She's got to prove it. So now she gets her tea and she pours. We can both see it fits the definition. It holds the tea. Pretty good. Still not enough. We've got to now make sure there's no other definition in our world as we know it that contradicts that directly. And if there's not, we tick the box, shake hands, sign the contract, we now know, we agree, that is a cup. This already is telling us about emptiness. We've established between us, it's a convention. We have decided that is a cup. Now we begin to look, then that's the conventional way it exists. In other words, so now we go into more detail about how it exists conventionally. Things exist conventionally in terms of three levels, and these are three ways in which Buddha is arguing with the prevailing views at the time. The first one is, things exist in dependence upon causes. This is arguing with a particular view that existed before, in relation especially to a self, an Atman, that is permanent, unchanging, and has no cause. That's the analysis of a being called a creator, and that's the analysis of a thing called a soul or a self. And Buddha says fundamentally such a thing can't exist. So much of the philosophical analysis and meditation is disproving that. So that by hearing about cause and effect, that's an argument against that. Next one is that things exist. This is dependent arising as a shorthand. It's like the shorthand for how can things exist conventionally. Things exist in dependence upon many factors. This is a massively important phrase. Although we just think, yes, a big deal. Who cares? Things exist independently, you know. But it's huge. The second one is that things exist in dependence upon their parts. So the first one is, things exist in dependence upon causes. You won't find anything among those causes. Because a thing is nothing other than the culmination of those causes. Actually, when I first learned this, learning philosophy from my philosophy teacher, Geshe Tekchok, and some really good books on emptiness have been published, you know, of his. Excellent. I can't think of the titles, of course. Sorry. So anyway, he used the example of the phenomenon called Rabina. And of course, that's why I remember it. You know? He said, it can be said that everything in the universe up to the first moment of Rabina is validly a cause and a condition for the existence of the phenomenon called Rabina. That's very interesting. So let's go to the second one. The next level, more subtle, also an argument against certain prevailing positions, more subtle, that phenomena exist in dependence upon their bits and pieces, their parts, that among those parts you will not find a thing, because a thing is nothing other than all the parts together. The subtlest meaning of this dependent arising, which is the real meaning, which is the one we have to get, is that things exist in dependence upon the word, the label, the name that we give them. But I like to do the analysis about the self in the second one. It's very tasty. It's a good example. It's not the subtlest one, but we'll discuss that. But the second one's a very tasty one. So now let's take the phenomenon called self, I, person, being, me. They're all synonymous. They're all terms that refer to a phenomenon like us. We're a person, a self, a me, an I. They're all synonymous, conventionally. We're one of those, okay? So now let's do the analysis of how one of those does exist and how this mistaken ma-rigpa, ignorance, thinks that I exists. And do a bit of analysis of how it's not true. So this is according to the second level. Okay, now, I is made up of two, we can say, keep it really simple, an I, your I, my I, this person, self, we're pointing to a phenomenon. Like we're pointing to a phenomenon here, it's called cup. We're pointing to a phenomenon there, it's called clock. It tiles the time. We point to this, it's the lid that keeps the tea hot. Whatever, it's a mala, you count your mantras. Everything's got its function. So, this is this I here. You've got to establish the parameters. So here are the parameters. It doesn't include that. It doesn't include this. This is the parameters of the phenomenon, in this case, of the example of a person called Rabina. This is the parameters. So basically we can say, this I, your I, same, is made up of two parts, body and mind. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. And they're two, remember? Not the same. Okay. Now, ignorance, Buddha says, this maripa, this primordial ego grasping. This ignorance is like double trouble ignorance. Like I said before, if we just didn't know how to play the piano, then it's not that difficult to play. This is a really important point. You can just, you've got the ordinary kind of ignorance that I don't know. That's easy to fix. You just learn the method and you whiz off and you learn it. But the ignorance we have got is not only do we not know how the I and everything else actually exists, ignorance has made up its own ridiculous, insane story that's the exact opposite, and we've been believing in it for eons. So it's like ripping away your skin to get anywhere, excuse me, burping, near the truth. If we didn't know what I was and had the mere ordinary ignorance, I think we can get enlightened in a couple of years. But it's the trouble is we've got the ignorance that has made up a story that's the exact opposite of the truth. And that's the main work, is ripping away those lies. The main work is ripping away the misconceptions in order to reveal the truth. It's a very interesting approach. So, this ignorance deep in our bones, the root delusion that gives rise to attachment and all the other 83,997 delusions, causes us to believe 1,000,000,000% every millisecond that there is in here somewhere a part, a piece of me, separate from the other parts, and that part is called I. Our language says it, expresses it. For example, we say, I have a hand. So conventionally, without analysis, that's perfect truth. You can see it. Look, there it is. But here, that this is where one of the many types of analysis they say we have to do, this sounds so weird initially, but you'll see my point, is we have to, one, to break through this illogic, is that if there's anything existing, it's either one thing or it's more than one. It's either one thing or it's more than one. This is a really good, this analysis is a really good proof of this one. So let's look at this one. So I'll tell you a simple statement. Keep it quick. Simple statement. I have a clock, a plate, I don't know, and a mala. There you go. I have a clock, a plate, and a table. So if you can all see over at this table, you look over quickly with your eyes, you see this sound coming out of my mouth, not his mouth. So you look in this direction, and you go, check quickly. Table, plate, clock. She spoke the truth. And it would be handy, wouldn't it, if what came out my mouth is in sync with truth. This is really helpful. Right now, the words we say, you go to internets and things, you go to websites, you drown in confusion and lies, you know. It's just beyond belief. I mean, it's like insanity. So here, I just spoke words, and those words are valid cognitions. And a valid cognition is one that's in sync with an it's got a referent object. It's a truth, a reality. So we can say there's a clock, that's a thing that takes holds the time. As we say, a plate holds your cake. A table holds your clock and your plate. Whatever. We get the definitions and we say, there it is. Tick, tick, tick. We just agree. Now, I'll make the statement again. I have a table, a plate, and a clock. How many phenomena have I mentioned? Phenomena are like nouns. This is interesting. I just say it this way. A phenomenon is a noun. So it's either a noun, in this case it's either a noun or a pronoun. How many of those did I state? Say the statement again. What did I say? That's one phenomenon? Yeah. Hey, there's, you missed it. You see, you missed it. That's one phenomenon, isn't it? I. Pronoun, I. Have a table, a plate, and a clock. That's four, right? Four phenomena. We all agree, don't we? Very simple. Uncomplicated. Four phenomena. Now, you would hope, if I speak the truth, that you can point out four separate phenomena. Isn't that truth? Isn't that reality? If I say I've got $4, you want to see $4, not three or not six. It's very simple. Four phenomena. You agree?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I've got a nose, a hand, and a foot. How many phenomena did I mention? How many? How many? How many? Say them. Say them. That's four things. One pronoun and three nouns. You agree? That's four phenomena. A phenomenon is an object of knowledge, an existence, and it's what the mind can cognize. And the mind cognizes nouns. Oh, I like to put it that way. So now, I have a nose, a hand, a foot. Now, if that is true, in the same way the previous statement was true, we have to point out four phenomena that are separate from each other. So here we can do it. If my plate breaks, this is one meaning of independent. One meaning of independent. My plate breaks, my table is happy. Do you agree? Not affected, is it? My clock is fine. They keep functioning. Rabina keeps functioning as Rabina. You get my point? The clock can function perfectly to tell the time if the plate's not there. In other words, there are four phenomena. Separate in this context means not dependent upon each other for their function. That's what it means. It's one type of not dependent. You get my point? Okay. So now, I have a nose, hand, foot. This is just to prove the first three. It's easy. There's a foot. Foot has job to walk. It doesn't need a hand to walk, does it? You accept that?
Yes.
My hand does not need a foot to hold my tea, does it? I can be minus a foot and my hand does a job, isn't it? My nose to blow snot needs neither a foot nor a hand. You understand that? You agree with that? That's three so far, isn't it? Now we have to find an eye, the fourth phenomenon, that doesn't depend upon a nose, a hand and a foot or anything else. Because that's what we believe is there. So please tell me where it is. What is it? What's its job? What's its, everything that exists has to have a function. So what's the function of that independent eye? What's its job and where is it? And point to it, please. That's the thing to do. That's the question. Any ideas? Just speak what you feel. We'll discuss. What?
It's the collective of everything.
Okay, good. It's a good point. It's another mistake. We either think there's an I that's separate, or we think there's an I that's everything. So, if everything is I, then I have two parts, remember? Mind and body. So if my body is I, right? Why would I say, I have a body?
Yeah.
Why would you bother? It's double trouble. A body has a body. Don't be silly. It's unnecessary. So if I have a body has many parts. So as many pieces are there, as many eyes that you've got. I mean, it's absurd to think it, but that's the logical analysis we have to do for that argument. So this is the other argument. We're trying to find a separate eye. Because when I say, I, how dare, you might say, what an ugly nose you've got, Rabina. I say, how dare you insult me? And you'll say, no, I didn't insult you, I just insulted your nose. But we think it's me and mine, you know. So I'll tell you what we think the I is. We all believe it's the boss. And that's how they describe this. It's like a puppeteer. Or like the chief salesman, they say. And we think of it this way. We feel we must have a boss in there that runs the body and runs the mind and makes sure everything's okay. That's the general idea we have, isn't it? Well, basically Buddha says that's the same as thinking there's a creator in the universe. We need the creator to run the show. Buddha says you don't need one. The bits do fine on their own. The bits do fine on their own. They don't need a boss. You've got to prove that to yourself. Of course, that's all, that's the meditation where you get the realization of it. It's an added component we've added on. Now, don't think this is saying there's no I. There is an I, but it's not the way we think. That's the only way the Buddha says it. You can't, in other words, when we say there's something, the big mistake we make is we want to point it out. We want to have it in isolation. We want to have it as independent, in isolation, separate from everything else. That's the way our words describe things, you know. So let's do another analysis to prove there can't be. There doesn't need to be this separate eye. This is an interesting analysis. I'll do it quickly. I'm holding a cup in my right hand. Do you accept that as a truth, a relative truth? So let's say I've forgotten how to do it. I had a stroke or something. Then you'd have to work really hard to get me to learn again what to do. Don't you agree? So if we did a really disciplined analysis, what you'd have to do is write down for me to learn all the bits and pieces of my body to retrain them, wouldn't you? So just, first of all, even the hand itself, the thumb has to go here, the pinky goes there, the index finger does this, and each of the pieces has their own job, that they all work together to hold the cup. Do you agree? Then you've got the wrist, and that depends upon this, which depends upon the elbow, which depends upon that piece, and that ligament, and the shoulder. So if you really start to write down, there'd be an awful lot of pieces of my body that I would have to retrain so that I can simply hold a cup in my right hand. Do you agree with that so far? So you'd have a long list, like IKEA. You get my point? It's a good analysis. Do you get my point? You have a long list of bits. And you think about it, it's very interesting. Each of those bits do their job, don't they? And there's not going to be the thumb won't argue with the pinky and say, you get out of the way, you're doing my job. They all do their job beautifully. All those screws and bits do their job nicely when you work it out in that table. It's a good point. Think about that. Then you've got a definitive list, would you agree? Many parts, do you agree? Now, what's the main player here? Clearly, if this is a dead body, don't bother. It's a live body, which means there's a mind here. Now, what are the parts of the mind involved? Well, first of all, I've got to have ear consciousness to hear you. I've got to have eye consciousness to see you and read and to see what I'm going to do. I've got to have tactile consciousness. I don't need smell. I don't need taste. But that's three of my sensory consciousness have to be working. Three different parts of me, remember? Now I've got to have intention to do it, attention to pay attention, concentration, mindfulness, alertness, all those bits and pieces of my mind, all working together with the bits and pieces of the body, all together to have the job of holding a cup. Do we accept this as an analysis? It's a logical analysis. You agree? So you've really got the list of every piece, and each piece of the body and each piece of the mind, it's got its own distinct job. Can you hear that? And we've completed the list. There's nothing left over, okay? So I'm successfully holding a cup. Now the question is, what role is left over for the precious, poor little left out self-pity me that hasn't been given a job? What job is it going to do? Hey, what job am I going to do? I want a job. Are you hearing me? Which job would I do that the others aren't doing? This is the analysis. Which job would I do, which we believe is in here running everything, what job has it got? Come on, just come up with your ideas. Don't worry about it.
I want to do this.
Okay, good. I want is called intention, which is the mind. That's covered. Done. Finished. That's mind. Next. Go on. No, I heard a word back there. What? That's mind. We've covered mind. What? That's mind. Covered mind. Mind's in there. That's done. Mind. That's mind. It can't be self and mind. It's either one or the other. That's mind. That's covered. That's done. That's included. That's got a job. It's got a job. Your mind's got a job. We're looking for a job that the eye needs to do.
Volition.
That's mind. That's mind. That's all covered. We've done all those bits. They've all got their jobs. They've all ticked their jobs. They've all got their jobs there.
It identifies what is doing there.
That's mind. That's mind. That's mind. What else? Any other ones left over? You think there's a job for I? This is a good analysis to be really rigorous. You will find there is no job. Because there's no separate I. It's the label we give it that we've made up and we've given meaning to as if there is a precious little I in there. We've inflated our I and it's this precious poor self-pity me I that we think runs the show because the pronoun called I believes as this I. We impute it on something. But it doesn't exist. It's nonsense. We've made it up. Can you hear that a little bit? It's good. When we get it, we get the biggest shock. But we don't get it because we still believe there's an I in there. And the proof is that when you insult me, I'll say, how dare you insult me? But so this is a really interesting point. If, as we know, the plate is separate from the cup, the plate is not broken if the cup's broken. The plate's looking on saying, oh, poor cup. Well, the same here. If, you know, if she says your nose is ugly, she's insulted my nose. If there is an eye there, the eye's going, phew, I didn't get insulted, poor old nose. The eye is not affected. But there isn't that separate eye. There is an interdependent eye, but we can't pin it down. That's the point. This is the tricky job. They learn this for 40 years and then go meditate for another 40. So, you know, it's okay. And this is not the subtlest mistake. This is not the subtlest mistake. But it's a tasty example. So any more questions? Any questions about emptiness? And this refers to everything that exists. Again, it's very simple. Look at the cup. Would you agree that my cup has a base? Would you agree my cup has a base? My cup, one phenomenon. Base, two phenomena. Take the base away. Where's your cup? If you take the base away, is there a cup? No. Because why? Because cup is a name we give to the bits and pieces put together that But cup is not a separate piece. It's the name we give it. You can have a handle with, you can have a cup without a handle. That's okay. That's an extra bit. And even a lid. But for a cup to be there to hold tea, that it has sides and it has a base. So they are the parts. So we can say, my cup has a base and sides. It's like three things, the same as I have a nose and a hand, but it's just the name we give it. There's parts. And this is the subtlest one. And cup is the name we give to the parts. It's merely imputed cup. We give it the meaning cup. And this is the point about the subtlest one now. I always use the word prison. Conventionally, there is a thing called a prison, and I would say most of the prisons I've been to, some of the federal ones aren't too bad in this country, they're ugly places where you're sent when you're naughty or when they think you're naughty and you can't escape. And they're usually like ugly and noisy, and it's not a pleasant place to live. If you look up the real estate pages, you wouldn't say, oh, I live there, it's free. No. You won't. Because conventionally, see, the point is, the conventional thing has to fit the definition. You can't just say, oh, there's a cup, and call anything whatever. It's got to fit a definition. You see my point? It's got to hold tea. You can't call it anything. You can say it, but you can, forget the prison now. This could function as a toilet. Do you agree? Do you agree? You see my point? It could, a very small toilet, but it could, but you can't just say, oh, it's the moon.
Right.
You can't say that because it can't function as the moon. But if it can function as a toilet, but you want to start changing the meaning of a cup to a toilet, you've got to change all the dictionaries, all the languages, you'll be hard going, you know. So conventionally it's a cup, but if you can, it would for that moment function as a toilet, so it validly would be a toilet. Now this is the point about prison. The same thing. A prison usually is an ugly place where you're sent when you're naughty. But I've got many friends in prison who are happy. So a prison is a place where you'd be unhappy because it's ugly. Conventionally that's true. But because my friends who are practicing Buddhism have decided to call it something different. They've decided. But the woman on death row, 17 years in Florida, husband executed, lost the kids, accused of killing two police, totally innocent. 17 years of this insanity. And she said, at some point I realized I couldn't change anything, but they couldn't take my mind from me. So I decided I'm not a prisoner. I'm a monk. I am not in a cell. I'm in a cave. This is the most perfect example of transforming problems and realizing emptiness. She wasn't a Buddhist. She did yoga and stuff. But she had this extraordinary intelligence, I would say, that she was able to see that she could relabel something. And that's the proof of emptiness. Because the Buddha is saying this. A thing that is not dependent on anything, Buddha is saying, simply can't exist. It's an impossibility. It's a non-existent. The words are easy to say. But he's saying the ego grasping believes in an independent I. We believe in an independent I. And I was independent of causes, an I that's independent of parts, and mostly, finally, an I that's independent of our mind calling it that. So it's easy to prove that woman, she was able to see that her mind relabeled it, but it functioned as a cell. It functioned as a place, and she became happy because she changed her interpretation. That's the living proof, not just of compassion and wisdom, of bravery, but of wisdom. And because Buddha's saying, if something did exist without depending on the name and the mind, you could never call it another thing. It could never function in another way. And the second point is this, which is very evident. If you've never heard of a thing called a cup, ever, you would never know in a million years it's a cup until someone tells you it's a cup. In other words, when you meet, if it were an independent, if it were a cup in its bones, without depending on naming it a cup, then the moment you see it, you'll know it's a cup. It'll be evident here it's a cup. That's not true. Impossible. This is proving that things can't be independent of the mind, especially the mind. That's the subtlest one. That's the subtlest one. His Holiness said, so the thing is, okay, His Holiness said, things aren't empty. The I isn't empty of intrinsic nature, of an independent nature, because you can't find it. You can't find it. That's true, but that's not the real premise, he said. Things are empty of inherent nature because they are dependent arisings. This is the thing we have to understand. So dependent arising and emptiness, right now we have the two wrong views. When we hear emptiness, we hear nihilism. When we hear dependent arising, we hear real existence, internalism. And these are our wrong views. We've got to change these and become the right views and bring them together where we realize that every time we say something is empty, that tells us it's dependent arising. Every time we hear dependent arising, that tells us it's empty. So these in fact mean the same thing. And when we get this finally, that's the real middle way. When we realize dependent arising and emptiness refer to the same thing. And we finally get that non-dualism when we're a Buddha. Finally. The final one comes. That's how they talk. Are we communicating here?
Yeah.
Any questions, please? There's more to say, but you have to be prepared to wait a bit longer. Do you want to have a bit longer? Do you mind?
Yeah.
We can say more. You can go if you have to, I'm sure. Please, I'm not trying to hold you back. But I want to have any questions from this so far, and then I'll go to another tack. Look into the word emptiness, which we get very confused about. Yep. Yep. Microphone.
Can we say that things arise because they have a function? They have a purpose?
No, they don't arise because they have a function. We give them a function. That's the meaning.
The
of
mind.
We make things. If you think about it, we created a cup and we decided it would be a thing that's got a flat base that holds our tea.
Okay, so that means we created ourselves. These bodies,
well, the Buddha is saying finally
bodies.
Everything in the universe is coming from our mind. He is saying everything in the universe is coming from the mind creating it. Yep, he's saying that. Everything. The whole even karmically, the whole universe is a result of past concepts. Yep, he's saying that. Which is pretty emptiness.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, over here. Over here, this side. Yes, Zach.
So, according to the Buddhist view on emptiness, does that mean that there is nothing that truly exists other than mind?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
So
nothing. Mind is not.
Mind
not
also
exist.
Does.
No.
So but,
nothing.
So but then we can't go into like it's not saying nihilism, right? That nothing.
No, absolutely
exists.
Not. The opposite of nihilism.
So it's saying that there that everything exists, but with It's there, but not in the way that we see it.
That's right, precisely. As Lama Zopa says, when we realize that nothing has an intrinsic nature in itself, in its bones, when we realize that, which is emptiness, and I'll go into the word, it's as if there's no cup. When we realize the emptiness of the cup, it's as if there's no cup.
Mm.
But there is a cup. But what does exist, dependent arising-wise, is so subtle. It's as if it doesn't. That's how they say it, to put the two together. Emptiness doesn't mean there's nothing, but the first thing we think now is nihilism. And when we think something, we either think, oh, there's no cup, might as well kill myself, and then dependent arises, oh, there's a cup after all, grasp. That's over-exaggerating, this is under-exaggerating. They're the two mistakes. Except this is really, when we get these two, apparently Tsongkhapa says, understanding emptiness in this framework, you can never get the wrong view. But the one of the commonest mistakes in all literature and everything is misunderstanding emptiness as nihilism.
So we define, through our mind defines the boundaries of these objects, correct?
That's what we create everything.
We
create everything.
Then nothing, if there's no boundaries to define where an object ends and another begins.
Well, there are. That's what I'm saying. We create them. That's dependent arising. Conventional.
So if we
conventional
see,
is very clear boundaries. There's the cup. Look.
Yeah. Here. But if we can view, if we are achieved beings that can see this clearly as it is, then there is nothing separating the cup from the air around it. Is that
no, that's nihilism. They see a cup. No problem. When you're a Buddha, you'll see a cup and that holds your tea. It's very easy. But you won't be... See, another way to put it is that what delusions do is over-exaggerate everything. Delusions, as Lama Zopa says, delusions decorate on top of what is there layers upon layers of characteristics that aren't there. So by removing all those layers, you don't end up with nothing. That's nihilism. You end up with a cup that holds tea, but not from its own side.
But nothing else.
What do you mean nothing else?
Like that...
No, that's actually, you don't need to say that. It's irrelevant.
Okay.
That's irrelevant.
I understand.
Okay, good. No. Go back. Back there. Go, sweetie.
As I understood, compassion yields happiness.
Compassion. When we've got compassion, which means less. When we've really got compassion without attachment and aversion, we're blissful.
So what is it that is happening to me when I see the animals on the road?
Being harmed.
And I have this compassion.
Compassion.
But it creates extreme pain to me.
No, that's attachment that causes you pain. You see, attachment, if you're an ordinary person, we all have attachment. And attachment is a junkie that doesn't want to see anything upsetting. So at that moment, take your compassion away. Right there, your attachment has a panic attack and aversion arises. That's the cause of your suffering. You happen to be fortunate to also have compassion. So you want to make them completely separate. Compassion, if you have no attachment and no aversion, you would not suffer. It is literally impossible. You'd have enormous empathy, enormous compassion, enormous wisdom, and you'd think, what can I do? But it wouldn't be disturbing to you. You'd be like a rock of Gibraltar. It's hard for us to imagine this. But that's the Buddhist way of analyzing.
The reason I'm asking this is because I do something about it. I went back to graduate school to prevent this from happening.
That's right.
But the problem is that I don't understand how I can get rid of the attachment, because when I see the suffering, it immediately makes me suffer.
Because that's the attachment, that's right. Precisely, the Buddha says you can't. But this is a Buddhist analysis, not the one you learn in the university. This is a Buddhist analysis. It's a very distinct one, and it's quite shocking when we analyze it like this. But this is a literal understanding of it.
So how do you get rid of the attachment?
This is what I've been talking about all weekend. Control your body, control your speech, meditate, control your mind. Like we've been talking exactly, no more, no less. We've been giving all the
Then messages. I learned nothing.
Pardon?
Then I learned nothing.
You did.
Okay, I understand.
But we often don't see the connection. We don't join the dots when we hear it, you know.
Second question is, you said that when the lady was talking about getting rid of the insects as opposed to taking care of the plant, you said, well, you're choosing to kill a sentient being if she gets rid of the insects.
Mm-hmm.
But the plant is also a sentient being.
I understand. Not in the Buddhist analysis. It doesn't mean you destroy the plant, but the Buddhist analysis is, first of all, there's not an atom of space. You won't find sentient beings. Wherever in that plant, it's pervaded by sentient beings. Okay, put it this way. A sentient being has a mind and some level of the four elements. So there are subtle sentient beings that we can't see called spirits, whose bodies really are simply the air energy. But they're still mind and body. They've got some level of subtle body. We have got this physical elements. These are the four elements. The same elements as the plant. Exactly the same. This is physical matter. Exactly the same as the plant. The difference is this piece of physical matter is imbued with its own nervous system and its own consciousness. A plant is a piece of matter, but the Buddhist analysis would say it's not imbued with a consciousness. That's all. But that we've got to find out. We've got to learn that. I'm just giving you the Buddhist analysis.
Exactly, because according to scientific research,
I know that. I know exactly. I understand. All I can do is give you the Buddhist view.
Thank you.
To look into these things.
Thank you.
Yeah. 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 Who else? Let's go into the word emptiness. Oh, you go.
Yes. Thinking about the emptiness and the mechanics of the mind. So unpacking the, trying to understand the emptiness of self. And how self is not the mind.
That's right. Self will be a separate phenomenon, not mind, not body.
So all the bits are things like, even if we've gotten rid of all the attachment and all the delusions and all the...
But the virtues of the mind and the mechanics, intention, concentration, good memory, they always stay there.
Even if we don't have all the bits, though.
They're all the bits. They're the bits.
Right.
Of the mind. The bits of the mind are love, compassion, kindness, attachment, anger, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, right. Intention, attention. When you got rid of delusions, you have none of those left. You've got the virtues, you've got wisdom, you've got compassion, you've got eye consciousness, ear consciousness, if you're in the human body.
Right.
They're all the bits of your mind.
Right. So the, even if you don't, or if you lose those things, let's say if you lose your memory.
Okay,
like when you're getting
your
older,
mindfulness is gone.
Your mindfulness.
That's one piece of your mind that's gone, yeah.
It's just a bit.
That's just that piece,
just
yeah.
a bit.
That piece, yeah.
And so that's where maybe there's different levels of beings, and that's maybe why this human rebirth is so precious. If we have all our bits,
yeah, all the bits work nice. Exactly.
Even if we have
precisely.
Our memory and our
and the yeah exactly.
Okay.
But the other point is clearly the Buddha would say the human one is the best of a bad lot because we can access our virtue. Eagles have incredible concentration, incredible. Like whatever you want to call it, there's one called discrimination, which means you can discriminate between this and that. This is working every second. An eagle has an incredible one from 1,000 feet up. It can see the fish exactly and go right like that. They've got powerful discrimination. And they are neither good nor bad, and whether you're a monster or a meditator, you've all got those. And they help us do whatever job we do better, whether it's helping or harming. They're the mechanics of the mind.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yes.
So, okay, the word emptiness, I want to go into that because we get really, really confused. Okay. We hear, oh, we've got to realize emptiness. So obviously we've got another definition. So emptiness is the, okay, I have to use simple, ordinary examples to get us used to the concept. We use it in our daily life. We use it all the time. So if I go to my cup and I'll go, oh, it's empty. What do I mean?
There's
no tea in it. So it's empty of something, isn't it? So when it's empty, it implies there is something that lacks something. You agree with that?
Yeah.
So it's really easy, isn't it? You look in your bank account, oh my God, my bank account's empty. We know it means of dollars. Do you understand? And so where's Mary? You look in the room, oh no, the room's empty, means there's no people in there. So we do have this concept. So it always means two meanings. There's always something that does exist that lacks something else. You get the point? But secondly, you know, when you say the cup's empty, it's a surprise, which means usually you're expecting something to be in. This is a really important point. You don't walk into the supermarket where they have all the plates and spoons and look into the cups and go, oh, Mummy, all the cups are empty. Well, you don't expect them to have tea in them in the shop, do you? You get my point now? Did you get that point?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't expect. So it's only you say something's empty when you think it shouldn't be. You get my point? It's a really interesting point, this. It's a powerful point when you'll get to see more and more. So, this is a simple example. There is a cup that lacks something else. Well, Buddha says, conventionally, there is a self that lacks something. It lacks an inherent self. Conventionally, there is a self. Conventionally, dependent arising, there is a self, but we don't even get what the self is, because we think it's more than it is, that does lack a certain way of existing. There is a self that does exist that lacks a certain way of existing. So these are the two truths. So the empty is lack. My tea, my cup lacks tea. This is an obvious, simple, gross example. But here, it's the same analogy. There is a dependent arising self that lacks an inherent self. You could say it like that. So this is a very powerful way to counteract the idea of emptiness means nihilism. In the Heart Sutra, it says, so the Heart Sutra is just this list, not just, but it's this list of all the components of the universe according to Buddhist view of the world, and Shariputra, or the other one, Avalokiteshvara, is stating them. There is no this, there's no that, there's no this. So he's just stating these different lists. The first list is the five aggregates. Then there's the 18 constituents. Then it's the 12, the four noble truths. Then it's the 12 links. All these different categories of phenomena we've got to go through to see that they're all empty. But there's a statement at the beginning that says this. And it's the first of the five aggregates. The five aggregates is Buddha's way of presenting that person in terms of five bits. We've just decided simply two bits, mind and body, but there's another way Buddha talks, and he's got very logical reasons for that. But the first one's called form, and it's just referring to our body. And so Avalokiteshvara says, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Form is nothing other than emptiness, and emptiness is nothing other than form. So what that's saying is this. Let's think of... Okay, Okay. I just said there's no T, didn't I? My T, something lacks T. So where does, okay, so let's turn, okay, this is the point. We say it is empty of T. I mean, we're saying, oh, it's empty, but it's complete the statement. You say it's empty, empty of T, right? So turn that into a noun phrase, and you're going to call it absence of T, aren't you? Can you hear that? That's a phenomenon. The mind always cognizes phenomena. A phenomenon is like a noun. A phenomenon is a thing that exists, abstract or concrete, doesn't matter. So, can I, so if there were tea in my cup, I would say I am cognizing a phenomenon called tea. Can you hear that? Tea is an is affirmative phenomenon. So if I am observing there's no tea in my cup, the name of the phenomenon I'm observing is called the absence of tea. Can you hear that? If I'm looking in my bank account and I'm expecting $5,000, right? If I'm expecting tea, so what I'm observing is the absence of tea. If there's no tea in there and you don't expect tea, you won't see the absence of tea, will you? You'll just see a cup. You get my point here? If you don't expect dollars in your bank and there's zero there, you won't be surprised. But if I'm expecting $5,000, I will get the shock of my life, won't I? And what is the name of this phenomenon I cognize when I see the bank where it says zero? But what do I cognize? Absence of $5,000. This is a really important point. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
If I ask you to look in my bank and you don't expect anything, you'll tell me the truth. Zero. If you don't expect tea, you just see a cup. So the absence of something is always cognized by a person who expects something. If Zach and I have been together for 20 years and he just left me, believe me, every time I go home, all I'll notice is the absence of Zach, won't I? But if you come and visit me, you've never heard of Zach, you won't notice the absence of Zach. You don't expect Zach. So this is already showing us that it's a fabrication. So, the dollars one, or the, this one is good, same example. But okay, form is empty as form. This means wherever there's a bank account, my bank account equals absence of $5,000. Emptiness. Bank account is absence of $5,000, and absence of $5,000 is bank account. So where does the absence of $5,000 exist? It's not tricky. No, no, no. Keep it more simple. Where does it exist?
In the bank.
In the bank. So you, that's dependent arising. So form, body, is wherever there is a form, there is the absence of inherent form, and which means emptiness of inherent form. And wherever there is emptiness of inherent form, you will find a form. So you can't have emptiness without dependent arising. You can't have emptiness without the conventional. So you can never have nihilism. Can you hear that point? You've got to get used to that point. So wherever there is... So in other words, you can talk about absence of $5,000 in general. Well, you know, and imagine being no $5,000. That'd be really horrible, having no $5,000. Oh my God, no $5,000. But if you're going to be a real experience of the absence of $5,000, you've got to find a place where the absence of $5,000 exists. And that'd be in a bank account. Or in your pocket. Or in your drawer. You get me? So the emptiness, we go, oh, there's no I. Chuck the baby out of the bathwater. Now that is the equivalent of $0. That's the equivalent of $0. That's like nihilism. There's no dollars, might as well kill myself. Oh, there's no I. Chuck out all the bits and you find nothing. There's no I, might as well kill myself. That's nihilism. And that's the cliched way we think it. So the absence of 5,000... Okay, if Zach looks into my bank account and there's zero there, what's the phenomenon he will cognize? Isn't it? $0. And if I look in the bank account, what's the phenomenon I will cognize? Absence of... They're different phenomena, aren't they? So $0 is nihilism, and absence of $5,000 is the... It's a dependent arising thing. It's You always see the emptiness of what you think was there, what you expected to be there. So all emptiness is when you finally, at a subtle level of your concentration, meditation, you've gone beyond your gross level, and you've done all your years and years of practice and prostrations and living in vows and prostrating and practicing and malas and blur and blur and prostrating and blur and blur at your mind, letting rid of attachment and aversion, blur and blur, controlling your body, controlling your speech, being kind, compassionate, and one day, in single point of concentration, after years and years of dependent arising, thinking and analysis, the penny drops. And what you cognize with your subtle mind is the emptiness or the absence of the I that you've thought since beginningless time was there. And you've now discovered it has never been there, it could never be there, and is not there. That's when you realize the emptiness of the fantasy I. And then you realize the dependent arising I. Are we communicating?
Yes.
Good. Yep. So we have to learn to use the words properly, that's all. That's part of the problem.
Okay, yep. Using the words properly, could you say the form phrase again?
Yeah, okay.
With inherent.
Yeah, sure. So every Buddha is saying everything's empty of inherent existence. Okay, so body, form, body is, wherever there is body, there is the emptiness of inherent body. And wherever there is the emptiness of inherent body, there has to be a body. So wherever there's the emptiness of water, there's got to be a cup. And whenever there is a cup, there's the emptiness of water. You can't have the emptiness of water in the sky. You can't have the absence of $5,000 in the sky. You can't have the absence of inherent form in the sky. You can't have the absence of inherent self in the sky. It's got to exist on the dependent arising self. Right there. If I look in my pocket and I'm expecting $5,000, I'll go, what did I just discover?
The emptiness of $5.
So where does the emptiness of $5 exist? Exactly where you thought the $5 was. In their pockets.
And the other part?
Which other part? There's no other part. We're just saying, I'm saying the same thing. I'm saying body. Buddha says everything's empty.
Right.
I forget your name.
Susie.
So wherever there is Susie, there does exist, right on Susie, the emptiness of inherent Susie. And wherever there is the emptiness of inherent Susie, there does exist dependent arising Susie. You can't have the absence of Susie nowhere. Because everything that exists has got to exist somewhere. And that's the two truths.
Thank you, I'm grabbing it quickly.
Good, wonderful, darling. Good. Go on. Yeah.
But does what you just postulated then depend on expectations?
That's what it's about, yeah, precisely. That's the whole point. I expect tea. I expected to be an I. I expected them to be $5,000. That's the suffering. That's the cause. Well, something made up, in other words. We've made it up, yeah. That's
but
the point.
If there is no expectation, does it all collapse?
No, it's just stupidity.
I don't understand.
That's something different. If you have realized the absence of an independent I, you no longer expect it. So you're cool. You've realized it. You're done. You're out of samsara.
Oh, okay.
That sense.
Okay, I get it now.
You understand? Yeah. So in other words, when we learn in high school, when we learn about attachment, aversion, all the delusions, we learn their particular function is to embellish. Then that helps us understand how ignorance embellishes the intrinsic. It's a more subtle thing it embellishes. So attachment embellishes on this cup. My attachment exaggerates the deliciousness. Ego grasping simultaneously, or ignorance in my mind simultaneously exaggerates and thinks the delicious cup is intrinsic here in the cup. And they work hand in hand. If I hate Zach, I have anger towards Zach. Aversion dumps ugliness onto him. Ego grasping or ignorance dumps inherent from his own side in his bones ugly Zach onto him. It's a more subtle mistake. It underpins all the other delusions. And they all function the same way. They lie. They embellish. They exaggerate. That's the key thing, that when we can understand this, we begin to understand Buddhist psychology. And the virtues don't embellish. So we have compassion, love, kindness, which are altruistic, which are amazing. They're our saving grace. But we don't realize in our psychological models that we have these poisons called attachment to what I want and aversion when I don't get what I want. It sounds cruel, but it's not. It's why we suffer. So literally, this is why I'm trying to give the example of the Dalai Lama. Can you see objectively he should be suffering? Can you see that? His people destroyed. His country destroyed. But have you ever seen the Dalai Lama? Heard him talk? You in the black jacket, darling.
Yeah,
have you ever seen him?
Yes.
Have you noticed he's not suffering?
Exactly.
There's the point. That's the problem. You've got to put those two together.
The problem is that...
Go.
The problem is, I understand what you're saying, or at least I think I
do. Theoretically, good start.
Yeah. But the problem for me is this. I am observing the animal that is dead. And I know what it went like. For example, I saw somebody being killed in front
That's
of me.
That's right.
So I see the suffering of this animal. This
That's
is an objective situation
right. exactly.
that happened
exactly.
to the
Dalai Lama sees the suffering of his people being executed
exactly.
and tortured. That's
Correct.
A fact.
Correct.
Fact. Fact.
It's a
then,
fact.
Then.
So what I'm finding a problem is to detach myself from that suffering in spite of everything that you said.
But who said that?
I can't.
Sorry, stop.
I cannot
stop,
do it.
Stop. Who told you to detach yourself? Who told you that? I never said
well,
those
you
words.
Said that, you said
I did not say
attachment.
Those words. I said give up attachment. I did not say detach. I did not say that. That's
no,
not the
I'm
meaning.
Confused.
That's right. You've got an assumption about giving up attachment. We assume you become detached. No! When you've given up attachment, you only have love and compassion left. That's, I now see the point. I now see your understanding. When you've given up attachment to what you want, you only see others and have this immense will to benefit them. That's why you never get unhappy. That's the point. Not detachment is the... That's the first stage. If you are giving up attachment to alcohol, you'd better detach yourself from alcohol. Yes.
Right.
If you are attached to some person who's beating you up daily, you had better detach yourself
exactly.
from this person. But eventually, when you've given up attachment... You don't have to
so,
worry.
Well, I'm sorry, but this is going to be a very stupid question, but what is it that I'm being attached to the suffering
attachment
that I want to be
is
suffering?
For eons old attachment, like I've been saying a million times, it's okay. We are the bottom line of attachment is a junkie in us that is attached to what I want. That's it.
Well, I don't want this animal.
No,
I want this animal not to be
no,
dead.
No, attachment in you only wants the nice things. And an animal dead is not pleasant. So aversion, it's totally self-centered, but it's embarrassing for us to hear this. When if you had attachment and aversion without any compassion, you'd be a vampire. You couldn't give a damn in hell about that dog. That's the whole point. If you see people are very selfish, are very narrow-minded, it's because they've got attachment. You've all got attachment, but you happen to have the saving grace of compassion, which mitigates it. Are we communicating?
No. Sorry.
It's okay. Can you hear the difference between a virtuous state of mind and a non-virtuous?
Yeah.
Compassion is empathetic and connected to others.
Yes.
And they're our saving grace.
Yes.
So you clearly have that. But what we assume in the models that you're describing is that compassion brings suffering to you. That's our biggest misconception.
Well, in this case, not in all cases.
Well, no, in this case.
In
but
this
it's hard,
particular
But it's really
case.
Hard to hear how compassion does not cause you suffering. It's what the Buddha would refer to as a self-centered attachment to get what I want, like a junkie, and aversion when I don't. Okay, have you ever been unhappy in your life?
Yeah.
Has anybody ever disappointed you?
Yes.
Do you ever get angry in your life?
Yes.
Do you ever get attached to something?
Yes.
Greedily wanting it and freaked out if you don't get it?
And not quite, but I understand.
But, well, I mean, I'm not sure. But Buddha's saying we've all got that, but it goes to really subtle levels. We just don't think it's such... It goes to primordially subtle levels, and we don't even notice it. That's why it's hard for you to say. Just think about that as well.
Okay. Thank
well,
you.
I'm trying to go home. It's 4:30. Unless you have more questions about emptiness. To get clear. Yes, darling.
Can you review inherency one more time? Can you review inherency one more time?
Inherent?
Yeah.
Inherent, intrinsic, existing from its own side, existing by its own nature, existing in and of itself, existing from itself, they're all synonyms. And to get used to that idea, it just means that in the bones of the cup that cupness comes from itself. Buddha's saying cup comes from our mind that labels it that. Roughly speaking like that.
Thank you.
And if it were inherent, the real meaning is if it were inherent, it would not depend on anything. That's what ego thinks. That's the meaning. But nothing cannot depend on anything. In any way, in all form or shape. Do you understand? Roughly speaking that. Okay, good. What else? Yeah.
Can you teach through
microphone. Teach what, darling? Will I teach it?
Yeah, just for a few minutes.
4:32. Shamatha meditation is you sit in a spot and you decide to pay attention to the breath coming in and out of your nose. And you, the job is to pay attention to that breath and not pay attention to the thoughts. It's not to relax. It's not to feel good. It's not to make the thoughts go away. It's to simply train our mind to have a strength of attention that isn't distracted like a little bird, like we are now. So you strengthen that attention and it gets deeper and deeper until eventually you actually have incredible subtle focus. That's shamatha, in essence. You're going to have many objects, but it's a good start. Buddha started with the breath. It's a training. It's not to feel good, it's a powerful training to train our attention, which is all over the place now, to stay on one thing. That's it. And it demands enormous effort and clarity. And I did an entire retreat with Lama Yeshe one time. We did 5-minute sessions. It's very powerful. Yeah. Often people mistake it for feeling nice. Okay. Oh, I had a lovely meditation. I sat for 42 minutes. Yes, yeah, spaced out for 41 of them. Do you understand?
But do you put in... I do Theravada meditation.
Yes. Same as, we're talking the same thing. Same instruction. Same teaching.
So
Buddha's teaching.
Yes. Do you put intention to it? Some people talk, they put the intention.
Well, you must
love.
Have an intention as I will. And then attention. They've all got their own bits. If there's no intention to do it, you won't even bother. Intention is the first step. Intention, I'll walk out that door soon, you know that. It's because I have an intention to walk out the door. You mean motivation by intention, sorry. You've got to have good motivation, otherwise you're just doing a samsaric action. Watching your breath is, an animal can do it. It's not virtue, and that's a good point. That's why Lama said, thieves need mindfulness. So you have to have a good motivation. Absolutely. Otherwise it's not a samsaric, it's a samsaric action otherwise. That's so important to understand. All right, people, we can go home, don't you think? But that reminds me, thank you for that. So this is a key point about the bodhisattva path, that we need to cultivate the powerful wish, the long-term motivation. I want to develop my marvelous potential so I can be a benefit to others. That includes you. You know, so it's the biggest one you can have. And as His Holiness says, bodhisattvas think in terms of eons. So everything you do, eat, sleep, go to the toilet, because there's nothing intrinsic about eating and sleeping and going to the toilet. They are conventionally samsaric activities, but the moment you do them with a pure motivation, it becomes a dharma action. That's the point. So you can be washing the dishes while your holy husband sits there doing his meditation. He thinks he's holy and you think you're samsaric. If you've got a pure motivation, honey, your action is dharma and his is samsaric. It's the motivation that makes it virtue. So do whatever you do, like your music. You do it with the wish to benefit, to lift people's hearts. That's an every note you play is virtue. That's how easy it is to practice virtue. Just have a pure motivation. It's powerful. And that proves emptiness. Do you understand? So we just put the two truths together. We put the two wings together. Compassion and wisdom, okay? So I've got to go now. And tomorrow I go to Nashville to see my friend on death row. So think of him. He's going to die soon. He's getting ready for it. The last meeting we had, he was cracking jokes. He's so funny, this fella. We spend time laughing. He's amazing. And because they're going to electrify him, which means fry him from the inside, because that was when he was sentenced in the 80s. It's so medieval. So he was trying to work out how he's going to think about the fellow who's this far from him, putting on the hood on his face and putting the electrics on him, you know, and the sponge on his head. I said, well, he's thinking maybe I should try and have compassion for him. I said, well, I think it's better you keep your own mind focused, because this guy is doing his job. Let him be. It's not your business. Have compassion, sure, but your main focus should be on you internally doing whatever prayer you want, you know. So he stays focused when they fry him. Can you think of that, isn't it? So think of Mitch. His name is Mitch. He's an amazing fellow. I'll see him tomorrow. And the one who thinks of torture all the time. Think of him too. Have compassion for him. At least he's in a place where he can't torture people. His mates won't allow him on death row. I promise. Huh? I forget. Can't forget. I forgot his name. He's on the movie Chasing Buddha. But I'm not trying to give the man away. I can't think of his name. Can't think of it. Okay, you people. Come on pilgrimage with me. Come on the trek with me. Chasing Buddha. My Chasing Buddha is 20 years old. That's ancient. You've all got those copies. And the DVD. I saw the DVD. The CD's gone. Devotion. That supports my projects as well. So anyway, thank you everybody for having me for these 7 days. And always thank Robbie. He puts me up in 103 Rosewall Lane, Carey. It's my home in Raleigh for 22 years. I've been coming here for 22 years. I think 97 was the first year, Robbie, was it? I think it was. So let's hope I come again before I'm 80, because I'm 74 now. You haven't seen me for 3 years, so I've now got 3 years older. Maybe I'll come when I'm 87. Who knows? No? Next year? We'll see. Okay, we'll see. So we just dedicate between all of us collectively, thinking how amazing all these days together, thinking, analyzing, listening, discussing, penetrating, internalizing, one step closer to our enlightenment, how fantastic for our sake and the sake of others. Chang chob sem chog rinpoche ma kye pa nam kye gyu ching kye pa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong de du pa va sho. You say something, go on. You do your thing. What are we going to do?
Please turn to page 100 in your gold prayer books. Go ahead. Yeah. And we'll offer a Thanksgiving mandala to Venerable Rubina.
And all the Buddhas whose words these are, okay? These are the words of the Buddha.
Okay. Sajipuki Chukshi.
Now we think of all the all our teachers, that they all come and continue to teach this next prayer.
Jetun lame ku te rajen cheng nam ka chin le chok chu ge pa dang Jalo zang ten pe dren me sa sum yi idro we mun sel ta chu.
Thank you, precious one. And now we imagine very happily. Are you going to continue to sing? No, yeah. Next one. When you say this, you think that happily the Buddhas all happily accept our offering with joy. Yeah.
Idam guru ratna mandala kam niryatayami.
Okay. Well, that's it. We're done? Cook? Done? Thank you, sweetheart.
Someday we'll get it.
No, that's it, exactly.
If people would like to offer katas to Venerable Rubina.
Thank you, darling.
Please take a line. And Venerable Rubina, on behalf of all of Kadampa Center.
Robbie's talking.
they're used to that, yeah, just ignore.
Listen.
It's great to see you so healthy and lively.
Healthy and lively at 74. Like an old lady, healthy and lively, yeah.
Transmitting the wisdom of our precious lamas.
Oh, wonderful.
And we humbly invite you to return to Kadampa Center,
Robbie.
ASAP.
I enjoy it. Well, you see, sometimes I do editing retreats. I do more and more now editing retreats. But that's no good because I don't see you, so there's no point in saying that. Maybe I'll come to... I've got one in New York. I'll go back to New York where I'll be a month. So I might come to Raleigh. Robbie might have to have me for a month.
To Light of the Path.
Oh, that's a possibility.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. We could do
Please
that.
Please come to Light of the Path.
I can do that. We'll see. Good. All right.
And then we have to acknowledge all the people who made this week such a success. Of course,
Definitely.
Donna Cease, her incredible work as a
Thank you,
program
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Linda Saw, who's our visiting teacher coordinator. Jill Marie, who's our chief organizer and behind-the-scenes person.
Thank you, Donna.
Everyone who drove, food, and all our sponsors.
Thank you, Andre. Thank you.
And also on our visiting teacher team, Susie Bohm and Laura Carballo.
Okay. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, dear.
Thank you, everyone.
Good. Thank you so much. Thank you for taking care of me. Thank you, people, all of you. Thank you, darling.